WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone.
Well, yes, welcome.
Yes. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Peter.
And a new addition to Team Night Call, at least for tonight, the almighty Jade.
Jade is here.
Yeah, you can reach her.
A lot of people already know Jade because she's part of the promotions team.
And also,
Greater Media. She's also on
Riff 2.
Riff 2, Saturday nights at midnight, and Midnight Metal.
Yeah. So
wildly popular show.
So she is the gateway to this all. This is a phone-in talk show where you get to give your opinion, as Mr. Announcer told us. And you got to call 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
The deal is you tell Jade what you want to talk about, and she says, hold on, and turn your radio off and listen to it on hold, or we all get crazy if you come on the air and your radio is still on. Well, as usual, a lot going on. Jolene Jordan is always trying to convince me that we got to go national again. We got to get a five-day-a-week show again. And I go, I don't know if I can handle it.
Exhausting.
And then, on the other hand, there is so much going on that really... I didn't do
it.
Jay, did you do that?
She's in the other room.
Okay. I don't know. That's
that's later.
Yeah. What the hell? How did that happen?
I think it was set up on automatic.
No. I'm looking at it. It's not.
Demons in the studio.
Demons in the studio. We'll talk about eating the rich later because, as usual, they are eating us. So 313-298-WRIF. Tomorrow is Martin Luther King Day, a national holiday. Some people have the day off. A lot of schools are closed. A lot of schools are having in-school programs and what have you. You know, and I think what happens is that when this comes around every year, it almost kind of gets cliched when people talk about the history of the Civil Rights Movement, what Martin Luther King Jr. brought to it, his eloquence, and in many ways it's easy to forget what that was all about.
Yeah, for sure.
The whole history of this country as a revolution, beginning in revolution, as a cauldron of revolution, was always expanding the people who were included, because most people were excluded right at the beginning. As democratic as the form of government was, and we've talked about this a lot, it was for white propertied males. But even there was a codification of a democratic guarantee of liberty and the pursuit of happiness and all that, it was just amazing. So people that wanted in, the other people that weren't white propertied male, had to fight and fight and fight and fight, and it continues.
Yeah, it sure does.
And it continues. And, of course, there are those who want to conserve everything as it is, just as they wanted to conserve white propertied males being the only one that can participate in government and in public life and all down the road.
Yeah, it's pretty depressing how much it still exists.
Well, it is hundreds of years later, and you'd think that these people would get over it. But they're protecting privilege. And oftentimes, most times, it actually is economic power and privilege, the elite. But actually, in many ways, the elite have been all about let's let everybody in because they're not threatened by it. And in many ways, it's just sort of a psychological bulwark, if you will. If you know, I don't want those people in who are different from most of us.
Right.
You know, I don't like them.
Terrified.
So, yeah, yeah. Who cares if you don't like them? You know, don't hang around with them. There's no law about saying you have to hang around with them, but there shouldn't be laws excluding people.
Absolutely.
This should be for everybody. It's called a democracy, you know, or if you what are those conservatives? It's a representative republic or whatever. Whatever it is, everybody belongs in it with the same rights and privileges and duties that everyone else has.
Yeah, and you know, people today of all different sorts, you know, gay people, and they're fighting for a lot of things these days as well. And you know, I don't know, not doing so well in some of the states.
Yeah. Well, the Martin Luther King Day celebration, there's going to be a rally in March for jobs, peace, and justice, something that Martin Luther King would have been right there with. In fact, it's going to be at the Central United Methodist Church, this particular rally beginning at noon tomorrow. That's East Adams at Woodward Avenue, right by Comerica Park, downtown Detroit. There's other events around. I know there's always something in Southfield and what have you. And it's a place where, in fact, Martin Luther King preached.
That's right.
Yeah, because Central United Methodist Church has always been a...
Is that where he gave the original I Have a Dream speech? He did it here first in Detroit.
He did it first in Detroit.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, there was...
I remember where that was.
There was a big march in 1963 where United Auto Workers President Walter Reuther walked arm in arm with Martin Luther King. And then later in the year, I guess that was the same year as the big march on Washington where he gave the speech.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another speech that he gave. When he became... You know, it's odd. I was going to say, and you know, I'm always talking about precision in language. I was going to say he became more and more radical. I mean, he did in the sense, well, maybe in both senses. One, radical going to the root, to be able to understand the root of issues, of problems, of what have you. But also getting more extreme. And that usually sounds bad because most of the extremists around today, we don't like. And they are kind of bent on causing people harm, like George Bush. Or you know, or these people that are willing to take out civilians in their pursuit of sometimes we're not even sure what. But Martin Luther King, maybe the I Have a Dream speech still can send chills down my spine. I mean, African American preachers have this manner of speaking that is so intense in the timbre of their voice and the
captivating
the utilization of. Were you in Washington? Were we together at the inaugurations? I forgot. I know you went. No, you weren't.
I went to the counter inauguration.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but here, he gave a speech in 1967 at Riverside Church in New York City, and it was called Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. And here's what he said. I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, now, a lot was going on in 1967, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. He's not talking about violence. He's talking about, in fact, he was obviously philosophically, religiously committed to nonviolence. He says a true revolution of values, this is Martin Luther King Jr., will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. And we're going to morph into Haiti in this discussion. This is perfect because I could imagine where Martin Luther King would be on this today. He says, with righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see the individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say, this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of South America and say, this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. Then Martin Luther King Jr. went on to say, a true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This is in the middle of the Vietnam War, remember. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. And, you know, he's not talking about Afghanistan and Iraq. He's talking about Vietnam. And Martin Luther King finishes this section with saying, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
Mm. Wow.
So, Your opinions on that and anything else, 313-298-WRIF. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, there is places where, well, I shouldn't say places, actually singular, a place where I sent money, and that was to Doctors Without Borders. And also there's other things there as well. Boy, I don't even want to. For some reason or other, I don't even want to say this title. I'm still old school, you know. I get embarrassed about saying, but it's the subtitle of it, History of a Haitian Holocaust, and that there's more to it than just bad luck having been, you know, right at the center of a fault. I mean, when you're poor, you always get hit the worst. Whether it's Katrina, whether it's fires, people that die in fires in homes, they're like 80% poor people.
Yeah.
Floods in Bangladesh, poor people. So it's, again, the consequences of poverty, what Martin Luther King was talking about, and some people think is why he actually got assassinated.
Oh, but, my gosh.
Yeah.
So in the midst of it all, the psychos come out.
Yeah.
And that includes Pat Robertson. And he was basically, how did he say that? Oh, boy. About French. Oh, yeah, the French. He said that when Haiti was still a French colony, its leaders swore a pact to the devil to get out from underneath the heel of the French. And, I mean, it's like, what century are we in, dude, really?
Well,
and if they had found the Lord Jesus Christ, they would have been fined.
You know what? So he says, I saw a clip of it tonight, and he said that they'd made a pact with the devil. True story. And Pat, there is no devil. That's the first piece of information.
Sorry with that.
Secondly, true story. Who made the pact with the devil? The Haitian people? I mean, he knows nothing about it. Toussaint Louverture, who was the liberator of Haiti, this black general, actually he was a slave, and the French had brought black Africans as the English did, and the Dutch and others did, to the New World after genocide. I mean, this is our Western culture, folks, that we like to ignore. After completely wiping out the indigenous population, they brought African slaves over, and Haiti was the first place where the country was actually liberated. This slave, Toussaint Louverture, there's actually a terrific song by instrumental by Santana with that name.
Oh.
And I can't think of his first name. Glover.
Danny.
Thank you. Danny Glover, the actor, is supposed to be making a film about Toussaint Louverture.
Wow.
Which ought to be pretty bloody.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. But so true story, as always, everything that comes out of Pat Robertson's mouth is a lie.
Well, so I decided to call the 700 Club and complain about how angry I am about it. And the other thing is some people had started something that if you call, they have to pay $1 every time you call the 800 number. It costs you nothing. So I was also trying to just, you know, cost him money. And but I sat on hold and hold and hold forever. But I had plans. I had plans. I had conversation in my mind, in my head. But I finally hung up. But I had all intentions of complaining.
Well,
I tried.
They would probably say bless. But you know what strikes me?
Yeah, they would.
Is how these guys continue. I don't know. I had that thing about
Rush Limbaugh.
Well, forget Limbaugh. I mean, you know.
He's trying to out Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck. That's my opinion.
Well, you know, they have an audience of about a third of the population, mostly angry white guys that can't get ready for the 21st century.
And who love Sarah Palin. Love me some Sarah.
I don't want to talk about those people. We are doing them such a favor.
I know we are.
Yeah, because what people like Rush Limbaugh do, I mean, they're two separate phenomena. Rush, Pat Robertson's just totally crazy.
Insane.
Because,
completely.
Remember, he said that Katrina was punishment for God's punishment for the sins of that city.
Yeah.
And he said 9/11
oh, yeah.
was God's punishment as well because there was lesbians in New York City. Yeah. There's lesbians in Topeka.
Yeah.
Why the hell didn't they? Oh, man. Anyway, someone always reminds me, it's singular. Dr. James Dobson, the founder of Focus on the Family, another right-wing whack job. And he says, an influential voice for Christian conservatives. He's about to depart from the organization he created, and he's starting a radio program. He already has one. So he's going to finish hosting his daily radio show for Focus in the Family. And now he's always in the news, and he's a spokesperson. And his radio show has 1.5 million listeners on 1,000 stations.
I don't want to know one of those people. I mean, he is truly frightening.
Let me ask you a question.
What?
If our audience was reduced to 1,500 people, how fast do you think we would not be sitting in these chairs?
Yeah.
We'd be out of here really quick. If you do the math, that's what his average listenership is per station, 1,500 people.
So these little psycho stations.
So how the hell does he get on 1,000 stations? It's because of these right wingers say, oh, the liberals dominate the media. The ownership is overwhelmingly conservative, and so when they think about who can we have on to meet our public service commitment? They're going to syndicate Jillian Jordan's show and mine, Peter Werby. No, they're going to say, well, let's get James Dobson. Well, he's a total whack job that doesn't believe in evolution even. So what? So, I mean, these folks have exposure so out of proportion to what they, to the draw they really have. I mean, it's absolutely.
Well, because they do obscene things all the time. Things.
Well, that's one of the things. But on the other hand, Rush Limbaugh, in one hand, he throws raw meat to these, like I say, these angry white guys who gives them permission to not feel compassion towards what's happening to the people of Haiti.
Yeah,
because
or anyone beyond their own nose.
Yeah, because once you can say, oh, this is just a ploy for President Barack Obama to look compassionate.
Unreal.
They go, oh, yeah, screw him, man. I hate him. I want our country back. So, screw those Haitians, too. Don't they kind of look like the president? No wonder. That was the other thing.
Oh, yeah. He said light-skinned, dark-skinned.
Yeah, he snapped. He, being the president, snapped right to it when Haiti was in. What was he supposed to do?
Yeah.
What was he supposed to do?
We'll deal with this later.
I'll get back to you in a couple of weeks
right.
or something. But, I mean, we're spending all this time talking on the most hate-filled, hateful people with lack of compassion. I always use this example from Philip K. Dick's book, Do Androids A Dream of Electric Sheep, which was made into Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that you could tell the difference between the androids and the human beings, because they were identical, even, you know, the interior, is they had to look in their eye and they gave them this little thing, and they the difference was they lacked the capacity to empathize with other human beings.
Yeah.
So Philip K. Dick, who's a wonderful writer for science fiction, his message was, if you don't have empathy, you're not a human being. And
so then, therefore,
yeah,
not human beings.
Yeah, hello.
Well, karma's a bitch. You know.
Yeah, and payback, as I always say, as
there
we say in Detroit,
MF.
Yeah, paybacks are MFs. Yeah.
Have fun.
You know, there's somebody, maybe we should get to this person right away, because this is scary. I wonder if this is the same guy. He's calling. Remember, we used to have, when we had the national show, we had a regular caller from Bradenton, Florida.
I do.
What was his name?
It was Armand.
Armand. I can't. Let's just check this, because I got more to say. But I got to. There's open lines, by the way, 313-298-WRIF. It's listed as Mike from Bradenton, Florida. Mike, hi. You're on the air. This isn't Armand, is it?
No, this is Mike Gibson from, I'm actually from Birmingham, Michigan, but I'm calling in.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, it's not Armand.
All right,
we know that voice.
There's a couple things I wanted to talk about. Well, one of them was Rush Limbaugh, supposedly on his radio program, made some, as an encouraging Americans not to send economic aid to the Haitians.
Right.
The guy has no human compassion whatsoever.
Absolutely.
I just can't even believe anyone would have the nerve to say something, anything bad about this, you know?
But
you know,
yeah.
And other Republicans are even saying, you know, well, we're embarrassed by this guy. This is going to ruin his status in the Republican Party. Other Sean Hannity, even on Sean Hannity's website, he has he has a Red Cross listing on his website. On Rush Limbaugh's website, he's got like a gold standard thing. He's got no Red Cross thing on his website. The guy is just unbelievable, unbelievable.
But you know what, Mike? What he wants is lots of people talking about him. And I know it's hard not to, because when someone really crosses a line like that, it's pretty much impossible not to.
But, well, and you know what else? Glenn Beck has stolen his spotlight, and he wants it back. So he has to just get a little ruder, a little cruder.
Damn.
Right. There's another thing I want to talk about, and that's how this $100 million economic stimulus for the Haitians is going to be. I think that this is going to improve our status around the world as Americans. You know, people are going to look at Obama and see him as the compassionate man that he is. And you know, under Bush, the world thought of us as, you know, selfish, you know, cutthroat, self-interest. But this is going to improve his status around the world. People are going to look at America and say, you know, they're a little bit more compassionate than they were under Bush.
Gotcha. What are you doing down there, Mike? You just there for vacation? Or
I'm just there for vacation. I'll be back on February 13th.
All right, man.
All right.
Thank you very much. Enjoy. I guess the sun is back, so you have a grand time. And, I forgot about this. This is for Rush and the rest of those people. Oh, what happened? Didn't work. How come? Didn't work?
I don't know, Peter.
Doesn't work? What's going on here? I don't know. I pressed the button, nothing happened.
Deja vu.
Yeah, okay. All right. Avatar,
yeah,
the movie, has been winning lots of Golden Globe Awards. I don't know. Did it get Best Picture?
I don't know.
All right.
I don't know.
We'll check. We'll check the news. But I haven't seen it either. I'm holding out to see it in IMAX 3D.
Oh, I heard that's the way to go.
Yeah. But here, this is from, let's see, this is from a CBS affiliate, online news reporting from Chicago. It's a titanic battle, and it's in the 3D of reality. A Chicago alderman versus Avatar. 11th Ward Alderman James Balser believes the new blockbuster movie is anti-military and anti-American. Balser is a decorated Marine veteran of the Vietnam War, and now he's going into battle against the film that may turn out to be the biggest moneymaker of all time. He says he hates the message, and he's not alone. In the movie, an army of mercenaries led by a villainous Marine invades the idyllic planet of Pandora and goes after the peaceful blue creatures who live there over deposits of a precious mineral. Balser says the film makes Marines look like lunatics. In reality, he said, we are a good, generous country that helps people. We are a good, generous country that helps people. Well, it's nice to be able to think that.
Yeah, I'm sure that those civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan would probably argue with that. And, you know, I think this guy's afraid to talk about a little thing called Blackwater.
Well, as we know, it goes back considerably. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, there's way down at the bottom of it in the center column, there's something called From Wounded Knee to Iraq, a century of U.S. military interventions. But before we get that, a number of people every so often discover Smedley Butler.
What, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he is, I can just read this. War is a Racket is the title of two works, a speech and a booklet by retired U.S. Marine Major General Smedley Darlington Butler, one of only 19 people to twice be awarded the Medal of Honor. And he frankly discusses his experience as a career military officer and how business interests have commercially benefited from warfare. Now, here's what he says. War is a racket. This is a Marine general, and it always has been, he says. It's possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which profits are reckoned in dollars and losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to be to the majority of people. And that's where we get to the alderman, who says that we are a good, generous country that helps people. Now, this goes back a ways, because he operated almost 100 years ago. But here's what this Marine general said his career consisted of. He says, I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. This is a Marine general. I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1902 and 1912. These were continued U.S. military interventions there. I brought to light the Dominican. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests in 1916, helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies in 1903. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts, operated on three continents. This is an ex-Marine general. And what subversive commie publication do you think this appeared in 1935. Reader's Digest.
Really?
Yeah, which we always used to call Reader's Disgust.
My gosh.
But on this website, which you can find on my website, it is incredible. I mean, it would take me the rest of the show to talk about. It begins with the Wounded Knee Massacre, where 300 Lakotas are massacred at Wounded Knee. But 1890, Buenos Aires, interests protected by the intervention of troops. Hawaii, the independent kingdom, overthrown and annexed. You ever wonder where we got Hawaii from? In Chicago, breaking of a rail strike, 34 people killed by U.S. troops. These were strikers. China, Marines land and to protect U.S. interests there. In Korea, in Panama, in Nicaragua, in China again.
And we're still in the 1800s.
Yeah, right. 1932, troops intervened to stop World War I vets from protesting, broke up this camp of protesting veterans. Mm. Led by Dwight Eisenhower and Douglas MacArthur. In the new Soviet Union, U.S. troops fought for 4 years in 1917 to 1921. And I'm way into the 30s here, but back in Mexico, 1914 to 1918, Dominican Republic, there was an 8-year Marine occupation, on and on and on and on like this. So to say, and can we say things like Vietnam, where this, what does he say, a good, generous country that helps people, the United States military in Vietnam, of which the alderman, participated. Millions of civilians were killed there. And the war, of course, was necessary because...
Why?
What was the reason?
What was that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's, you know, all the other wars had good reasons.
No.
Well, what about World War One?
This is what everyone does to you every time.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a good reason for World War One, right? And everybody knows it.
You know that you stump... Yeah. Almost everyone you say that to, right. Every time you say it. Anyway, this list of intervention is staggering.
Yeah, and there's something I get every week. I love this online Detroit newsletter. It's called Metro Mode. Metro Mode. And you can go to metromodemedia.com, and they'll send it to you for free. There's an introduction to this article that says, War is Hell, in the intro. Because, John Wayne movies aside, what happens to people that are ground up in this is truly horrible. What people do, what is done to them, sometimes they're necessary. Sometimes wars are necessary. Very infrequently are they. But and there's very few United States wars that were necessary. World War II, what else? I don't know. I can't think of any. Here, this is what the Armory for Democracy goes suburban. Remember, this used to be the Arsenal Democracy, Detroit. Now it's the Armory for Democracy, it says here, goes suburban. When you're looking for work, it helps to have friends. Metro Detroit is getting a big boost from Uncle Sam as defense sector companies come to Michigan and auto suppliers morph into defense manufacturers and suppliers. The numbers are staggering, says the article. According to press releases from Senator Carl Levin's office, in fiscal 2010, the Metro region will receive $5.7 billion from the National Defense Appropriation Bill for dozens of projects, and that's up from the year before. So this is This is what the military-industrial complex is. This is when you start having an economy that is a warfare state that is completely rooted. Well, you say, hey, so what? You know, we got jobs.
We have to do it, yeah.
We got jobs, and we got enemies. And if we didn't have any enemies, we'd find them. The Army expects to grow jobs in this region from 6,500 to more than almost 10,000 by 2015, an increase of 3,300 new jobs. All the Automation Alley and Lawrence Technological University in Southfield are teaming up to prepare displaced automotive engineers for the defense job growth. So we better make sure that we have enemies, because if not, the whole thing's going to collapse. And, you know, if you go back to World War II, after it was over, because remember, we were in a permanent depression, and the only thing that finally brought us out of it was large-scale government funding of the war industries. So the depression, which began in 1929 and never really ended till the first quarter of 1942, when suddenly billions of dollars of tax money went to the arsenal of democracy, which was Detroit and other places. Yeah, General Dynamics is building an $8.2 million facility in Sterling Heights for testing military vehicles. The vast heart of the local military-industrial complex beats in Warren. These are just little blips out of it. Besides General Dynamics, Land Systems, and Raytheon, the big players include BAE Systems, newcomer Oshkosh in Warren, and AM General in Livonia, Caterpillar, Navistar Defense. So you might say, again, well, doesn't this all work? I mean, this is all funded by our tax money, and it's a wealth transfer. I mean, that's the concerns always of these right-wingers, unless it's preparation for war, which they're just insane about. You know, they lose their any common sense about it all. So our money is taken, so how much of it goes to the military-industrial complex of our wages? 10%, 5%, 12%? I have no idea, but a percentage of it, right? And it's taken by the government, and then it's transferred to all these companies that were just I just mentioned. And then some of it goes in profit, some of it goes to people that are jobs. So we got thousands of jobs there, and it all works, right? Well, it all works unless you are a soldier and just had half your face blown off. Yeah. It all works unless you're an Iraqi and you're in that, I forgot the name of the square, where these Blackwater guys just opened fire on civilians and killed 17. Or it works if you're working in one of those industries, you're one of the almost 60,000 Vietnam soldiers that didn't come home, or one of the millions of Vietnamese that got killed by the American military machine. It doesn't work very well. So, and you'd say, well, it works, though. You know, still, it works. Maybe it works badly, but it works. Well, it doesn't work very well, as we can see the economic straits that we're in now. It worked during the depression, but now we are on a permanent military-industrial economy, and it just doesn't work anymore, because this pump priming by the government, this transfer of our money to the government and then to these war corporations, just doesn't have the impact within the economy that it would if it was spent on civilian projects, for instance. So that's what it's all about, folks. It's the military-industrial complex, and hey.
We're just living in it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. All this weekend, 101 WRIF has your free passes to the North American International Auto Show, January 16th to the 24th at Cobo Center. Experience the next generation of transportation at the North American International Auto Show, with more than 700 vehicles on display and North America's largest and most prestigious automotive showcase. Listen and win.
Please state the name or number.
From 101 WRIF, everything that rocks.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
It's another new year, and your debt is higher than ever. Credit card balances that keep growing. Rising medical bills. Maybe you lost your job, or you're afraid of losing your home. That's the bad news. But you can work through your debt problems with help from Credit Card Relief. No, we're not a consolidation loan. Not another one of those credit counseling deals, and not bankruptcy. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. If you're struggling with too much credit card debt, call us for a free consultation. We have an outstanding record of performance helping people get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. And it just occurred to me, you remember Mike called in earlier from Bradenton, Florida?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's down there on vacation.
Listening
and he's listening to the program.
The show.
Yeah, all right. Let's take some more calls, and there's some open lines. We don't have many commercials tonight, so you guys can fill it. 313-298-WRIF. When I say guys, that's about 95% of our callers, but we certainly extend that gender-wide. All right, let's talk to Ron. Ron's in Warren. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
We're good.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to say, you know, it seems like even regardless who's in office, it seems like Americans are always one of the first ones to aid anybody that's in trouble, even when they're not in trouble. I mean, we're located throughout the world on missionaries and people helping clothe people, helping them, you know, when they're starving, even when there's not a catastrophe somewhere. So regardless who's in office, the American people are some of the most compassionate people in the world. And I hope people continue to be that way. I just, you know, I politics aside of everything. I'm going to hang up and listen to your comment after that. Thank
you. All right. It is mixed. I mean, most of American aid is military, but some of it is, in fact, for good things. But I want to talk about charity a little later and why there is such a... I mean, why do, for instance, the Haiti is on the island of Hispaniola. Half of it is the Dominican Republic, and that is actually considered one of the, by the Happiness Index, one of the better countries in the world to live, the happier...
And then right on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah, so what's up there? Or why this border line down south of us, Mexico, intense poverty, mm-hmm. violence, what have you, above it, the standard of living is eight times that. What's going on there? Let's see. Here is John. John, hi, John. You're on the air. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Hazel Park.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I have compassion and sympathy for these guys and all that, but my question is, when is the United States going to start taking care of their own people?
This is something that everyone's saying, Peter. This is a lot of people have been saying this.
I have sympathy and compassion, but when do they start taking care of our own people?
Well, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen, there is enough money in this country to take care of to create a country where we don't have what's going on now, and to help other people as well. It's just being allocated so badly because the way the economy is set up. Yeah?
Yeah, but like I said, I got sympathy for him on it, but I like to see, some government step in and help their own United States country. That's
yeah, but do you get my point? My point is that it shouldn't be either or. Do we either help ourselves? I mean, it would make sense. It would make sense like a family. If you saw this country as a family, the first thing a family wants to do is make sure that it's secure, that its needs are met, that we're not wanting for anything. And then if there is anything left in the budget, then we might try to help a less fortunate neighbor. But here it looks, with so many people suffering, with losing jobs, foreclosure, millions of people working at jobs below what they had previously made and all that, it would be easy to say, well, why are we giving these folks $100 million? Why don't we put $100 million into Detroit or Cleveland or help people with their mortgage notes or something like that? So, I mean, I understand the sentiment, John, but I think what we got to look at is how is this whole deal structured? So listen up on the air, and this actually leads me into something I was going to talk about anyway, but now we will go to what I was trying to do before. All right, Jalene, don't jump, because we're going to play loud music. It's our Eat the Rich segment, and if you're on hold, please stay there. We'll get to you in just a minute. 313-298-WRIF. J.P. Morgan Chase kicked off what is expected to be a robust reporting season for the nation's banks on Friday with news that its profit and pay for 2009 soared. Remember, this is one of the bailout banks.
How did this happen? Yeah. What's going on?
In a remarkable rebound from the depths of the financial crisis,
wow.
J.P. Morgan earned $11.7 billion last year. Remember, that means $11.7 billion.
And they're giving money back, right?
They're paying it back. Okay. Yeah, they are. So $11.7 billion. That's what $11.7 billion means. And most of you know that, or all of you know that. We're giving $100 million, all of us, the taxpayers, to Haiti. But they doubled its profit from 2008 and generated record revenue. The bank earned $3.3 billion in the fourth quarter alone. These cheery figures were accompanied by news that J.P. Morgan had earned $26.9 billion to compensate its workers, much of it will be paid out in bonuses. That's up 18%, with employees on average earning about $129,000 a year. That's on average. Workers in J.P. Morgan's investment bank on average earned roughly $380,000 each. Top producers, however, expect to collect multi-million dollar paychecks. So, John, this is what I'm talking about. There used to be a slogan that says, how are you going to drink clean, clear water if you can't get the hog out of the stream? And that's what this is all about. And it gets worse. Goldman Sachs, and whose people, which include some people in the Obama administration, who are virtually responsible for what we're suffering now, get this. As it prepares to pay out big bonuses to employees, Goldman Sachs is considering expanding a program that would require executives and top managers to give a certain percentage of their earnings to charity. Oh, so they do have compassion. They are nice. We were wrong about all these rich son of a bitch. The move would be the latest in a series of initiatives by Goldman to soften criticism over the size of its bonuses. So, in other words, it's not really that they have compassion. They just don't want people getting so mad that we might just stop saying, oh, we don't like them. We think they're bad. And maybe really either demand people do something or show up outside of their offices with pitchforks and torches.
Right.
I think everyone's, even the right one, is using that.
Or just a sign.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. The size of his bonuses, which are expected to be among the largest on Wall Street, bringing average pay. Remember those pikers over at J.P. Morgan Chase? The average was 100. Yeah, that puts them in about the 92nd or 93rd percentile of income. At Goldman Sachs, the engineer of our economic woes, the average pay is going to be $595,000 for each employee, with far higher amounts for top performers.
Oh. Life is good for them.
Yeah. So that puts them, if you're making $600,000 a year, I think that puts you in the top 1% or at least the top 2%. Goldman set aside $16.7 billion for compensation in the first 9 months of 2009. And in good years, the firm dedicates about three quarters of its compensation budget to year-end bonuses. The firm is expected to report later this month what could be record profits of about $12 billion for 2009, according to analysts, blah, blah, blah. The charity idea would be similar to a decades-long program at the failed investment bank Bear Stearns, which required more than 1,000 of its top workers to give 4% of their pay to charity each year and then check their tax returns to ensure compliance. Man, all right.
Can they handle it?
Yeah. Assuming a similar percentage and level of participation, that would mean Goldman's top employees would commit to giving hundreds of millions of dollars to charity. Though a precise amount would depend on the level of contributions, blah, blah, blah. Well, listen, as soon as this happened, my wife and I sent money to Doctors Without Borders. And you can go to that link. You can either Google that Doctors Without Borders. They're in Haiti right now. And you can go to my website where there's a link, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And you know, you can contribute there. And they're great with it. They have like the lowest administration budget of any charity. I mean, you got to have some.
Yeah, of course.
You got to have some.
They're legit. They're good.
But here is the problem with charity. I mean, we all think charity is good, right? But charity is vertical. In other words, it's those that have give to those that don't. Well, women. Isn't that a good idea?
Isn't that what we're always saying?
Yeah. The problem is, why are there so many people that don't
have? Who need. Absolutely.
Why are there people we have to give our old clothing to? Why are there people that we have to contribute food to lay it at our door? It's all about distribution of wealth. And you have these folks here that within, they have... They're paid, and then these are bonuses. We're talking about bonuses in the billions when, as John noted, we're talking about giving the Haitian people $100 million. Why the hell doesn't somebody march down there and tell Goldman Sachs, you're paying for the whole damn thing that we're giving to Haiti? And we're not talking about $100 million. We're talking a few of your billions. So what we really need is a tax structure that figures out what allows everybody in this country to live at a minimum a decent life, that it's not based on what can you grab at the expense of other people, which is the way the system is structured now. And it's true across the world. I mean, why are some countries wealthy and other countries impoverished? Why are some countries just torn by strife? Are they have inherently dumb people or people that have not risen high enough on the evolutionary level? It would take racism to make that kind of assessment. How about this? As I mentioned, and as everyone knows, and anybody even in wealthy suburbs knows, there's foreclosures going on. A townhouse dubbed New York City's skinniest house has sold for $2.1 million. The home, it's
a building.
Townhouse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 9.5 feet wide.
How do you do that?
Well, it's 42 feet long.
Yeah.
So that, if I'm doing my math right, it's 4,000 square feet, which is bigger.
Very narrow.
Which is bigger than your house and my house combined.
You're right.
Right. And given what things have been selling for in our suburb. But the townhouse was listed for sale at $2.7 million. Man, somebody drove them down to $2.1 million. It's two bedroom, two bath. Last sold for $1.6 million. And famous people have...
And Margaret Mead, the anthropologist.
And Edna St. Vincent Millay, the poet. So,
yeah.
But this is, if you didn't have the money, by the way, you could rent it. $10,000 a month.
Oh, that's a little out of my price range.
Yeah. So then, you look how many homeless there are in this country.
Right. Yeah, I think when you sent that to me, you said, think Haiti.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Let's go on. 313-298-WRIF. There are...
open lines.
There are open lines, yeah. I'm thinking of about six things as usual. This is Sergeant Nicholas from Monroe. Hi, you're on the air. What's the rank in?
I'm a combat engineer, Army, 101st Airborne Division.
Okay.
And I heard you guys speaking about Blackwater and how the troops over there just randomly opened fire. And, you know, I listen to a lot of radio shows. I listen to a lot of TV, a lot of commentaries. And, you know, I hear all this stuff all the time about how the soldiers over there have done all this, that, and the other wrong. And, yeah, a lot of my brethren over there have done things that, you know, are frowned upon. But in retrospect, there's a lot of troops over there. And until you've actually been in a situation over there, for people to sit back and judge and just see, listen to what you hear on the TV and what you see in the paper, there's a lot of things that go on over there that don't make it.
I'm sure, you know, but wait. Are you trying to tell me that citizens can't make assessments of any policy unless we are right there? I mean, war policy or anything else? Come on.
It's not a policy of the United States Army to open fire on civilians.
Well, these weren't United States armies. These were these mercenaries that just went berserk and just shot the hell out of this square that, I mean, nobody disputes that they shot hundreds and hundreds of rounds of ammunition, blew apart cars, and it was clear from the forensics that most of the civilians that they killed in this square in Iraq were trying to escape.
Yes, there was a lot of civilians that were in the crossfire, but under certain stresses in situations like that, you know, did they ever really go into much detail on how those soldiers were provoked? I was less than 2 miles away from that incident when it happened.
Well, there was just a guy that testified that said it that was there, was one of the Blackwater guys, and he just said it was unprovoked. But, you know, they must have, probably what happened is, listen, when you're an army of occupation, when there's not regular frontal warfare is what you know, most wars have been in the past, when you enter a country under false pretenses, as Bush sent you guys and, you know, your comrades there, the same thing happened in Vietnam. The same thing happened anywhere where there's an invading army that is resented by at least a portion, if not a large portion, of the population, is that it's not like the guys on the other side's got uniform. You don't know who's there. You don't know what they're going to use, and they don't have regular equipment. So they always say, like, for instance, a car bomb is a poor man's F-14. So it goes with the territory, and I'm sure that there is any number of valiant soldiers that mistook what was about to occur and shot people that didn't deserve it or weren't really the enemy and probably lived to regret it the rest of their lives.
And it just so happens I am one of these people. However, my point being is from what I was hearing on the radio station, is how all soldiers are the same thing, same cut in line, same rank and file. You have to remember, I was an E7. There was men under me and there was men above me. And to generalize the entire army and, you know, the like you were speaking about the book from Reader's Digest, how the Marines went there, those were men who were ordered by somebody who was ordered by somebody who was ordered
absolutely
by to go do this.
Absolutely.
And the guys like me who come back from Iraq and can't get a job, because this is the perception that other people take, that we're all a part of this evil, maniacal machine, and it's not true.
Wait. For one thing,
we would never go that far.
You totally misheard me if you heard that. For one thing, ultimately, who's the blame? You're right. Is who gives the orders? And who, I mean, how did we enter Iraq in the first place? Under total false pretenses, and put you and others in this untenable situation, and then expected you to perform without ever making an error. What was at work, and what this Marine general was talking about? I mean, he wrote this thing 75, 85 years ago or something like that. We were talking about the role that the U.S. military played all over this hemisphere in China, and to some extent when they were used to break strikes here in the United States.
Okay, and this is something I would like to point out, though. My combat specialty was combat engineering. I went in, set up generators, pumping stations, bridges, built makeshift hospitals, set up helipads, repaired roads, but I was also detached as a part of a combat unit. Nobody really, you don't hear anybody talk about the job that I performed, about how I would sit on a piece of equipment all day, leveling roads to, so people could drive, so people could get to where they needed to go to seek medical treatment. They don't speak about that. They speak about the atrocities that is committed. Now, I really wish one time of the people that are over in Iraq, we as a soldier, and I say we as a soldier because anybody that is on the ground over there is a soldier, and we are as one person.
Yeah.
We are over there to do a job that is handed down to us from a managerial level, being the president, who, I'm sorry to say, nobody who is elected into office has a goddamn clue of what's going on anywhere in the world outside of what they see on CNN or NBC.
Well, I know. I mean, it's political. It's economic. It's long range. I mean, they don't call you guys the grunts for nothing. I mean, yeah, I know that they're ordered. They are, you know, you're orders. But and listen, the fact that you can come back and probably served a couple tours at least and can't even find a job, I mean, what the hell does that say? I mean, this country always says, you know, oh, we support our military, support our troops and all that. Where's the support for you?
Okay, and I don't deny that. I can't even get VA benefits, and I have been awarded the Purple Heart twice.
Yeah, that is.
I was a victim of a roadside bombing, and I was a victim of faulty body armor that was distributed.
Oh man,
distributed to people in my squad, and basically throughout the whole army. But I don't cry about that. All I'm saying is, and this is all I ask, is for people to stop saying, oh, our troops in Iraq and how we're doing this and how we're doing that. Yeah, there has been incidents over there. But for once, I would like to see somebody take the time to go over there and ask some of the units that are over there that have done things to bring up and emphasize more on that. And with that, I mean, there's a lot of things you guys have said that I believe are right on the money. But
well, listen. I mean, in fact, and I got to go to the commercials right now. When the country was built up, I mean, it was the U.S., you know, Air Force destroyed the whole country's infrastructure. And then we have spent billions and billions of dollars on recreating the infrastructure. And three quarters of what has been rebuilt and our money has gone to do this and for all these contractors and what have you. And most of it doesn't work. And most of the Iraqis don't know how to operate it. So it's been a terrible mess. And I don't know, I mean, that you guys, and which I include the women in this, ought to be given all the benefits, ought to be given, you know, preferential treatment, ought to be, you know,
the best health care.
The best health care imaginable. And you're not getting it because the guys in the suits at the top, you know, to you, they're just, you know, you're just like a flag. They'll wave you, but when it comes down to substantial support and real support, it ain't there. Give me your last words because I really got to go. Just give me about a sentence or two.
If it was ran by the sergeants and the corporals, it would be the way it's supposed to be.
Okay. Well, the way it should be is not at all. But
yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate
it.
Yes, bring them home.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-493-8159. Now you have qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. Call right now for your second chance. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159. Do you see chalky water spots on your dishes and tub that drive you crazy? Those spots are a warning that your plumbing may have a serious limescale buildup. What you can't see is limescale clogging your pipes, breaking down your appliances, and blocking their heating elements. And that could be costing you $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove hard water limescale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare. Just visit bestofwater.com. HydraCare has been sold for years by the major utility in England as the ideal treatment to reduce and prevent limescale. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. Guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestofwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestofwater.com. That's bestofwater.com.
101 WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Still doesn't work. I keep pressing these buttons, folks, to get these. Why the hell does this thing work? Maybe it's broken. Anyways, you know, we do
it
these little.
It might be. Yeah. It's a remote start and not.
But I was going to play Happiness is a Warm Gun.
Okay.
Because five people have been shot to death in a home in southeast Texas. We miss, you know, there's a mass murder a week. Yeah, yeah.
At least one.
Yeah, yeah. You know, don't want to take away your guns. Don't call about that, you know, but that's the price of all of us having guns is there's a mass murder a week. It's Martin Luther King Day officially now, and if you're in the getting out and seeing how folks are celebrating it publicly in about 12 hours down at the Central United Methodist Church at Grand Circus Park, right near Comerica Park. There's going to be several hours of commemoration. There's going to be speakers, also an indoor rally and an outdoor march. And so that's beginning at noon at the Central United Methodist Church. I'm going to go down. You want to come down?
I'm working tomorrow.
Oh, that's right. You are.
Mm-hmm. And
you're rocking and rolling.
I am.
Yeah.
Let's give the phone numbers, because we have some open lines. If anything struck a chord with you, 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah. Now, I know all of you are following very closely Latin American politics, right?
Right.
But billionaire Sebastian Piñera won Chile's presidency Sunday in the country's first democratic election of a right-wing ruler in 52 years, and vowed to make Chile the best country in the world. All these billionaires are, you know, I forgot to print out that story about Mayor Bloomberg of...
Oh, how much? He spent $100 million or something?
Over that. And he gave his aides that helped on the campaign bonuses of hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Phew.
So this billionaire, Piñera, won the election in Chile, and his triumph over former President Eduardo Frei ended more than two decades of rule by the center-left coalition that followed Augusto Pinochet's brutal fascist dictatorship, which, of course, was ushered in by the United States. Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon and the rest of them happened September 11th, interestingly, 1973, wasn't that it? And was in there for a considerable number of years. Thousands and thousands of people murdered. But that was all, and that was more. The conservatives really had a role in that because it was the Chicago Boys. What the hell? All of a sudden, I'm blocking on the Economist's name that was all about this fascist country. But the reason I bring that in is because the people of Chile got tired of this center-left coalition. We do not have a center-left government in this country. We have, at best, Barack Obama is a centrist. Mm-hmm. He certainly isn't a leftist. He's not a Marxist. He's not a socialist or anything like that. He would probably be a center-rightist in most countries, I think.
Just like Bill Clinton.
Just like Bill Clinton, exactly. But so people got tired of the liberals. They got tired of the left, and got rid of them. And I'm sure I can just see all these right wing websites. But yay, they kicked out the lefties. They got a righty in. And this could be happening in this country as well, because now that there's a Senate seat up for grabs, it to replace the late Ted Kennedy, who passed away, yeah. And now they're having a special election in order to elect a new senator for Massachusetts. And it was just a slam dunk that this woman, Martha Coakley, isn't that her name? Martha Coakley. Yeah. Would get it because it's, I heard some right winger calling Massachusetts
it's the Kennedy country.
Yeah, it's People's Republic of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
They used to, and that used to be this right wing epithet because most of the communist countries called themselves the People's Republic of China or whatever.
Yeah.
And but now I don't even think it means anything to anybody. People, isn't that good? People's Republic, isn't that a good thing? I mean, there was nothing wrong with the name. There was what was wrong with the People's Republic of whatever those countries was that it really wasn't the People's Republic. But in any event, so now this this new model, you know that? What's the guy's name here? State Senator Scott Brown. He was a nude model.
Really?
Which and you know, that's completely okay with these conservatives, Christian conservatives. They don't care because they just want to take down these Democrats because they're
the guy on the right.
Yeah.
The right winger was a nude model.
Yeah. They probably even like rock and roll.
That's even funnier.
Yeah. So it looks like it's possible that people they're tired of the Democrats, so they're going to get some Republicans in there. And it's like I say, I'm almost sorry that Barack Obama got elected. It should have all just been given to these righties, and it would have all just cascaded downward.
Everything that's happening then would be on them.
Yeah. But you know what? Then people would say, we got to get these liberals in. And then when things didn't go well with the liberals, they'd say, oh, no, we got to get these conservatives
yeah, make up your mind,
back
huh?
in. Yeah, yeah. And I can't, let me see. Let me see if this one will work.
Good job, Peter.
No, wrong song, though.
not so good. Oh, I think you should give up.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
Wait a minute here. I'll never give up, but let's see.
Is this it?
Is this it?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that's it. You can call, by the way, while we're doing this. 313-298-WRIF.
They stand for greed that's unrestrained by shame or pity. They own the factory, the penthouse in the city. They pledge allegiance to their friends with lots of dollars. They concentrate the wealth and they disregard the squalor. Republicans.
Peter.
I hate Republicans. Baby,
you're
I can't
so
stand those Republicans. I hate that old Republican Party.
I do hate the Republican Party. I don't like the Democratic Party very well, but I certainly hate the Republicans. I mean, there's good
people. Who is that? I don't remember that song at all.
Let me see here. You don't remember? We used to play it all the time. The Happy Tones.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
I never could even find out. They're from Austin, Texas. Yeah. I actually just wanted to play the... Somehow it got away from me, but I just wanted to...
Well, I'm just glad you got the song to play.
There was a video of that, too, which is absolutely fabulous. The Tea Party movement, those wackos, they're now, they got something called the National Precinct Alliance, and they're trying to take over all these precincts that are open, because you can do that, and people in the Democratic Party have done that before. That they you can just get in there and you can kind of control the party, except they obviously want it for their far right wing agenda. Now there was this article too in the New York Times. It said the grand old party, as they call it, which really isn't. What do we used to call it? The greedy oil people? We had some other ones, too. I can't remember. Sees political gain in health care. And that's what they're all about. This, in Massachusetts, the Democrat supports the health care bill. The Republican, who doesn't even believe in evolution, is against it. And they're hoping that they can get political gain by defeating this health care bill. Now, do you think they really care about anything other than political gain? I mean, these people are...
Most likely, no.
No, no. So they don't care. I mean, is this bill flawed? Yes.
Yes.
Is it maybe even too flawed? Flawed to pass? Yes.
Possibly.
But the supporters say, look, this is the opening. This is the beginning. We finally have made a national commitment to national health care, something that every other industrial country in the world has. We have tens of millions of people, way beyond the 42 million that don't have it, but tens of millions more people that have crappy health care. I swear I hear a bad health care story every single day from people.
For sure.
It is totally. And, I mean, here we have Sergeant Nicholas who called up that can't even get proper VA care. So what do they see in a political gain? I mean, these don't start me. I hate Republicans.
I hate politicians.
Yeah, yeah. But and what's going to happen? See, I think people that vote Democratic have such a high level of integrity, when they see a politician that doesn't do what they expected him to do, and you know when they say, "Oh, look, Barack Obama's ratings are falling," you know, and they somehow think that everybody's going over to the right. But if you ask me, would you give Barack Obama a high approval rating? I'd say absolutely not. Are you kidding? I mean, a lot of the fall off from the from Obama and the Democrats is by people from the left. But so the tendency would be for people like myself and you and others to say, you know, both these parties suck, and I'm just going to stay home. I'm not going to even bother with them, which opens the door for these right wingers who couldn't care less what kind of scandal these people are involved in, how they advocate absolutely nothing. It's all just psychopathology. They somehow think that we're going to get back in power, realizing that the we in this pronoun really just benefits the ultra rich. So they are just lackeys for the big shots.
They just don't know it.
They don't know it. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and it must be something about line one besides the CD I can't get going, that I can't see the name here. So I'm just going to say hello. You're on the air. You want to talk about putting Michigan back on the map. Who's this and where are you calling from?
This is Bernie Groenfeld. I'm calling from Warren, Michigan.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I'd like to comment on the comments they made earlier regarding veterans.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I was married to a Vietnam veteran for 14 years.
Yeah?
These people went over there and they done what they had to do. Okay? Now, the government's coming back here and turning their back on them.
You're talking about
just
the...
Just like they're doing to the people from Iraq, Desert Storm, and the whole nine yards, they're turning their back on them.
Yeah.
Do I put Michigan back on the map? Get the people that own factories to reopen them and produce Michigan products. Get whoever the hell is the governor to come out and say, okay, we're going to give you a tax exempt, but we're going to produce Michigan products.
Well, you know, that's a wonderful idea, and there are people that have a whole Buy Michigan call. But, you know, the problem is that these companies figure, hey, why should I pay people Michigan wages when I can go over to China and pay people $1.25 an hour? That's the real problem, is that these companies never should have been allowed to go. I mean, and that could have been done. It could have been done by law. It could have been done by the unions. But, no, I mean, I agree with you. I agree with you, essentially.
Granholm went over there, and I don't know, God knows how much money she spent on that trip, to go over there and kiss somebody's back ass to finance something that she can't even produce.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, it's tough getting jobs in Michigan. It's like I say that what we're being blackmailed is that all these jobs have left Michigan and left the United States because Michigan workers and workers in the United States wanted to have a decent wage. And when the employers found that they could pay people less than a decent wage, less than a living wage, something that no one in the United States would work for, nor would law allow them to be paid, they just said, okay, we'll go find some poor, unfortunate people that don't have a minimum wage, that don't have a union, that don't have health and safety regulations and all that, and essentially, you know, we'll go back to the 19th century. That's the kind of conditions that employers like to operate the most in, where they don't have to spend money to pay decent wages, where they don't have to pay union wages and benefits, where they don't have to adhere to safety standards and what have you. But in general, Michigan made, good idea.
Yeah,
all right,
for sure.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Let's see, here is Carol in Lansing, speaking of the governor, just down the street. Carol, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I was listening to the young soldier that you were talking to just a short time ago.
Yeah.
And I've had this theory for quite a while. You know, we went into Afghanistan supposedly to, you know, try to find a 6'6" Arab terrorist, and that was to the thanks of Bush. But I really think that at that time Bush wasn't president, and for 8 years I believe that Cheney was president.
Sure.
Huh?
It's true.
True, he said, yeah.
We have colleagues in the kind of the peace and social justice movement who, I think it was yesterday or today, marched and protested in front of his house in D.C.
Cheney?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, and you know, we you know, I don't like everything that that President Obama is doing, but, you know, he certainly did inherit, you know, a bag of worms.
Oh, did he ever?
And,
heard of,
you know,
worms.
The thing that I truly believe about both of these wars is that they are purely economically based.
Well, yeah, there's both the pipeline deal. There, certainly in Iraq, all that oil, and the United States companies, oil companies, have been kind of pushed out of it a little.
But, well, the contractors are just making hand over foot.
Yeah, but the contractors, as Jillian said, make a lot of money as well. But and also, it's the war itself. All right, Carol, thank you very much. Appreciate
you.
Your call. Here, this is an article. I think this is on my website, peterwerby.com. And it's called The U.S. Military, Al-Qaeda, and the War of Futility. U.S. efforts to crush Al-Qaeda have certainly not failed for lack of resources. The U.S. military has spent about $1 trillion on its post-9/11 wars so far. It has an Army, a Navy, an Air Force, and a Marine Corps, which, like the Navy, has its very own Air Force. It possesses trillions of dollars in weapons, materiel, and other assets. It can mobilize spy satellites, advanced fighter planes and bombers, high-tech drones and helicopters, fleets of trucks, tanks, and other armored vehicles. It has advanced missiles and smart bombs, aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, and state-of-the-art ships in all shapes and sizes. It also has incredibly well-trained special operations forces, almost 56,000 elite troops, including Army Rangers and Special Forces, Navy SEALs, special boat teams, Air Force, Force Special Tactics teams and Marine Corps Special Operations Battalion armed with incredibly advanced weaponry. It has military academies that churn out highly educated officers and specialized training camp schools and universities. It has more than 500,000 buildings and structures on more than 800 bases, sitting on millions of acres of prime real estate scattered around the world, including in or near lands where various branches of Al-Qaeda operate. In addition, the U.S. military has manpower, approximately 1.4 million active duty men and women under arms, and another 1.3 million reserve personnel. It employs more than 700,000 civilians in support roles and utilizes untold tens of thousands of private security, hired guns, and various other kinds of private contractors all around the globe. These numbers would be further swelled by intelligence agents who aid military efforts, including 100,000 members of the civilian intelligence community. And then there are the allies the U.S. can draw on, ranging in Afghanistan alone from the Afghan army and police to tens of thousands of NATO and other foreign allied troops from more than 40 countries. And as our, was it Carol in Lansing just said, and they can't find Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
Well, what do we make of that? I mean, it's important that we have, if we didn't have now Osama bin Laden, and what this article estimates is a couple thousand members of Al-Qaeda. And remember, even just some poorly trained, poorly armed people with box cutters can do some deadly damage. Or a couple of guys put some explosives in a backpack and get on a train in Spain or a bus in England. And or we saw what the IRA was able to do to England, for instance. You wonder what's going on here. I mean, is this what's necessary, an armed force of this magnitude that commands this much resources and sucks this much from the public treasury, when long ago John said, why are we helping our own people? I mean, of course, the military-industrial complex it hires all those people. But the amount of money that is involved, if we're just into an economic thing and concerned about our economic future, much more could be created in terms of jobs, in terms of lower taxes, even if we didn't have this albatross of this enormous war machine and war budget. And it's, look at, I have such a mental block on his name, Ron Paul, who calls, for instance, on the right, along with people like...
on the right?
On the left. What's the guy from Cleveland that ran for president? That has the big, tall, beautiful...
Kucinich.
Yeah, thank you. bring those bases home. Bring our troops home.
Yes.
Yeah. And dismantle this military in concert with other nations and get ourselves out of other people's affairs. That would probably reduce the hostility towards us by 90%. What do we do by the other 10%? What do you think we do when we're in danger? We protect ourselves by what's necessary. This war in Iraq was never necessary. This war in Afghanistan is just creating more and more problems, and we don't need this huge military machine.
And nothing's getting any better.
It isn't. Let's see. Where am I here? When we are...
phone calls.
Yes, calls. Yeah. Yes. Here's Patrick in Jackson. Patrick, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got to say, I'm just really frustrated where it seems that there's really no difference between Republicans and Democrats. They seem equally as corrupt. I mean, if you look at Obama, he's got Geithner, Larry Summers, and we're all Wall Street guys. And it's, I mean...
worse than Wall Street, Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't like Bush and all those guys, Cheney and all them. They're, go back to old man Bush. They're just as bad as those Wall Street guys. And if you roll back the campaign debate footage, and you listen to guys like Ron Paul, I mean, he's a Republican, but his ideas, I mean, he was talking about economic stuff that's come to fruition, problems that were coming down the road that we're now encountered.
Yeah, but you know what? And what I always say to Ron...
he's a libertarian.
But yeah, what I say to Ron Paul supporters is, why not Dennis Kucinich? Dennis Kucinich is Ron Paul plus. And he doesn't have the negatives that that Ron Paul has. I mean, Ron Paul has pretty ugly stuff in his little bag too. I mean, he wants to leave abortion to the states, which would probably
not so much.
Yeah, and I'd have to remember other things, but maybe other people can.
We went through a whole list. Remember
What did you want to say about the smoking ban?
I don't really have any comments on that.
Okay. It says that after your name. Maybe that wasn't it. But all right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Tom. Tom's in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. I think, you know, every problem we're talking about, whether it's health care, the war, you know, even the media, you know, I mean, the FCC should be slapping around all these media corporations, but it all comes down to money. We got to get public financing and get the money out of politics, and we're going to get halfway decent people there, but the people are going to get elected based on their ideas and not how much money they have.
Well, I know, and it's actually getting worse. The Supreme Court has been hearing this deal where they would actually allow more and more money to be pumped into it. And I'll tell you, as a union member, and my union, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, does not make campaign contributions because we're in the news business as well as other aspects of performing. And I, of course, very, very opinionated, but other people, like the people on the national news programs, number of the local news stations, they don't want to say, well, you're biased. You donated all this money to Obama's campaign. But I don't want my dues going for having to support politicians. And it's necessary. It's necessary for the unions to pour in tens of millions of dollars to these campaigns in order to beat back these multimillionaires that give so much money to the right-wingers.
Yeah, but, you know, if it's one person, one vote, and we understand that advertising money is what determines how those votes are churned out, it's just so obvious that two candidates, you have some sort of system in each state where it comes down to a couple of candidates, and they get equal amounts of money, and, the FCC, all this money that they're raising, they're just throwing back to the corporations anyway,
Yeah.
NBC, GE gets big bucks for NBC TV commercials, I mean, it's just this, the money doesn't disappear. It comes out of all these corporations' pockets into the politicians' pockets, and then the politicians have to give it right back to the corporations.
Well, absolutely. Money runs the society. The society is run by the golden rule, right? He who has the gold rules. And were there to be fair debates, if the candidates, for instance, if Barack Obama and some of the other and Hillary Clinton didn't have tens of millions of dollars to spend on the primary, and somebody like Dennis Kucinich have
bare bones,
the three of them, and people would have listened to them. I wonder who they would have, if they still would have voted overwhelmingly for those two candidates. Well, Tom, thanks for calling from St. Paul, the Twin Cities. Appreciate it. When you call 313-298-WRIF, you reach our phone screener, who is Jade, the almighty Jade.
What a woman.
Yes, please tell callers that they can only call once in an evening, because I see the caller on number three is calling.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell her that rule.
Yeah.
Okay. We have very few rules here.
Yeah, right, right. So, let's see, here is William in Hardland. William, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is me again.
What do you mean again? What do you mean again?
No, I called last week.
Ahead, go ahead. Oh, you were sick.
Yeah, I'll let you know. I went to church today.
Yeah,
and I signed up for help paint houses for the needy and all that stuff.
Well, that's good of you. That's very good of you.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I grew up in Ferndale.
Uh-huh.
When I was a little kid, I got ran over when I was a little kid. When I was about 4 years old.
You got ran over?
Yeah.
You mean like by a car?
Yeah, I only had like 7 days to live.
Wow.
And I was like the neighbor across the street for when Drew and Mike was growing up.
Yeah.
I actually met Drew and Mike and all that stuff.
But you fooled them all.
You're alive and kicking.
Yeah, and I'm planning to come down there and see him.
See who? Me or Drew and Mike?
Everybody.
Yeah.
You guys are like family to me.
Well, I appreciate that. But you know, William, you got to come down during the day because this is, you got all these fences around here now with
security
cameras, security guards, and all that. So at night, it wouldn't work. But maybe during the day or something.
We're glad you're doing well.
Yes. Thank you, William. Appreciate your call. And let's see. Oh, maybe it was Andrew from Farmington Hills that had a comment on the smoking ban. Andrew, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good. Can you tune your radio completely off?
Yeah, it's off.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't like the smoking ban. In some ways I do, in some ways I don't, because why are they going to kick it out of bars and restaurants completely? I mean,
well, it's because then people like myself won't have to smoke the other end of people's cigarette.
Right.
Because we say suicide yes, murder no.
Right. I know a lot of people that eat don't like, you know, smelling cigarettes.
Yeah, that's what I'm...
But why are they put in the workplace also? That's what I don't get.
Well, I think, you know, business is way behind this because people that smoke have worse health. And if you're covering your employees with health insurance, you're doing more payout. So part of it, like most everything else, is economic. Right.
When did they say the effective date was going to be?
May 1st.
May 1st.
Because, let me see, can I tell them?
Yes.
Jillian Jordan is going to be playing at the New Way Bar, celebrating the first night in Ferndale, in fabulous Ferndale, the first night when there's no smoking. And, you know, they've had this ban all over the country, and people have survived, and bars have survived. And
I lived in Miami when they had that smoking ban right after I moved there, and I loved it.
And
I mean, it's a little easier to go outside and smoke a cig in the middle of winter in Miami.
Yeah.
I get it.
But I've been in New York, and I've been in San Francisco, when you just go, you know, outside of bars, there's usually 3-4 people standing outside smoking the cigs,
It's bonding time.
Yeah, you can bond. And inside, you can stay there for hours, and when you come out, your clothes smell as fresh as when you went in.
Real. Yes.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Open lines at 313-298-WRIF. And should we do this? Okay, we'll take a break. You call during the break. Brendan and Terrence, stay on the line, and we'll get you when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Do you know someone who always seems well-connected? Here's your chance to one-up that person and then some. Welcome to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, your online connection to half-off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses. Simply log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com for special online coupons and discounts you can't get anywhere else.
This week's featured deals are Axis Music Academy in Southfield in Canton, A1 Services Auto Repair and Detailing in Livonia, and Photo Video Creations in Dearborn Heights.
All you have to do is visit MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. You'll save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your computer. Heck, you don't even have to get dressed. No shirt, no shoes, no problem.
Shot naked, man. Yeah!
Dressed or not, just go to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and you'll be connected to these incredible deals and more. MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, man. Hey, like, this chair is really cold.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Are you having trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt, but now you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again, too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential, and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help you get out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
101 WRIS.
Everything that rocks.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, welcome back to our final segment. At 1 a.m., I'll have a couple of interviews for you. Matt Hearn, who lives in Vancouver, has written Common Ground in a Liquid City. Wow. Essays in Defense of an Urban Future. So this guy went all over the world, and he's talking about, there's a typo here, that ecological and financially balanced cities can be created. And he's a very lively guy. Sometimes you go, wow, that sounds real interesting. And also, this firecracker of a guy, Sai Khan, S-I-K-A-H-N, and he's a singer. So he actually got his 15th album CD just out. And he's got a book on how to do community organizing, like these right-wing teabaggers. That's what they're doing. They're figuring this out.
Yeah.
Sai Khan has been doing this mostly with the civil rights and labor movement, so it's a different deal.
Nice.
Speaking of civil rights, today is Martin Luther King Day, a national holiday. Many of us have the day off. Jalene doesn't. I do.
No. Holidays are my friend. Yes. I work every single one.
Yes. Pardon me. So we're honoring the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr. There'll be a public rally and march for jobs, peace, and justice occurring at the Central United Methodist Church at noon today. And there'll be an indoor rally with speakers, music, and then a march down Woodward. So
And it feels good to do something rather than just, you know, have the day off.
Some people are doing it at their schools. I don't know whether there's recognitions at businesses or whatever. But the doomsday clock has been set back. This was developed in 1947, right? Wasn't it by the...
this is this end of the world clock,
yeah,
right?
By the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. These are the guys that put together the weapon that could end it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been as close as 2 minutes before midnight. Maybe even one. Midnight is when we can, you know, they tell you if there's a nuclear attack, what you do is you bend over, put your head between your legs, and kiss your ass goodbye. Yeah, exactly. It's actually been set back. They don't do it every year, but first time in its 63. Why does it say that? It's been set back 1 minute for the first time in its 63-year history. In moving the clock from 5 minutes before midnight to 6 minutes before midnight, scientists expressed optimism for humanity's future, which is nice. It conveys, as you said, how close we are to the end of the world via catastrophe caused by nuclear weapons or climate change now as well. But it's interesting. You know, they're talking about nuclear weapons, and people are saying, nuclear weapons? Why? I mean, what year is this?
Because
this
isn't the 1950s. They're still out there.
They are out there. They're right now, there's 27,000 nuclear weapons, 2,000 of them ready to launch within minutes. Obliterate all of us. And it's by, you know, who has them are the Soviet Union and the United States still. Soviet Union, what century is this? Russia. So the United States has to work, and Barack Obama is not going as fast on this as he could, but he's moving certainly in a direction.
He's kind of busy.
Yeah, well, contrary to the nut jobs that were in before him. They were all about let's get more nuclear weapons, but
more of everything bad. That's what they were about.
They were indeed. But there was one thing more about that. I don't know. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number.
And if you have something you want to get in, call now because the show is.
Oh yeah.
Winding down.
By the way, there'll be a podcast of this available at noon on Tuesday, and you can subscribe to the podcast by just going to WRIF.com or my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and there's no charge. We'll just send them to you when they're ready. Here's Terrence in Hazel Park. Terrence, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, Jolene and Peter. Good morning to you.
Hi.
I'm listening to you talk. So many things baffle me. The main thing is, how does Goldman Sachs and the other one, or the Federal Reserve, made profits too?
Yeah. Terrence.
Darn it. Hold on.
Oh, no. Did you do? Wait a minute. All right, Terrence. Hold on. Terrence, we cut you off mistakenly, completely.
Are you here?
Okay,
right, continue.
Start again. So there was profits made, yeah.
Yeah, the United States, we manufacture nothing, and we export war.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, how does Goldman Sachs and the Federal Reserve and that I can't think of the other, Bank of America or whoever it is, how do they make these billions of dollars of profits and able to give their employees bonuses when there's nothing being made in this country? Where do they make their profits from?
Well, they make money on money. That's why it's this speculative crap game. I mean, the purpose of the stock market was to capitalize enterprises that couldn't do it through an individual entrepreneur or owner. And so you or I would say, okay, here's $10,000 for a certain percentage of the profit when you start to make them. But that's long gone. I think it's something like 90% of it all is speculative capital. So essentially they make money by making money, or by loaning money, by it's all fiction. It's all illusory. And at some point someone's going to say there's no there, and it's all going to collapse. It's a classic case of the emperor having no clothes.
Exactly. That's the amazing thing about it is that I've got to be paying on my mortgage, and another 100 million people do for them to make money, it seems. So if it's just computer entries, but yet they're going to give guys bonuses, so someone has to print these dollars to give to them unless they just add numbers to their bank accounts, and it's just all fake.
Well, they talk about printing money. I don't think there's even that much of it now. It all is just cyber wealth. There's not the real wealth isn't there. If everybody was required to bring all of their money and put it on a big table, there wouldn't be anything like that in real dollars out there, that's for sure.
So, audit the Fed, I guess. Let's get behind Ron Paul is doing at least one good thing. Let's help him audit the Fed.
You mean getting rid of the Fed? Well, wouldn't hurt me any. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. But it's like I
said. There's an answer I haven't heard.
Yeah. I mean, the Fed's one little small part of it all, and you could audit it or get rid of it or whatever. I mean, every modern country has a central bank, and, people say, you know, it's privately owned and all that. Yeah, well. When it was the government bank, it had the same thing. I can't even remember back in history, but there was a national bank that Alexander Hamilton ran? I can't even remember all that stuff. Oh, let's see. Here is Mike and Troy. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Small part of it all.
Yeah. Mike, good. Turn your radio off. You're on the air.
Yeah, what's up, man? Hey, I just got a question for the smoking ban and all that. Mm-hmm. Why do you have to, pick certain places out to ban them? One, they just ban them all together in all the public places, and it'll be a smoke-free, healthier environment.
Well, it actually kind of has been increasingly going that way because a lot of places, a lot of businesses won't even allow you to smoke outside of the building.
Yeah.
They essentially, because they want to, there's a lot of things that happen. And it's not just that they have payouts for medical care. It's also that employees that smoke take more days off. Are off more days because of illness and what have you.
Right.
Because smoking a lot ain't good for you. Not a bad idea, though, Mike, but people would say, what about my rights? All right. Thank you very much. I'm usually for that, but I am completely libertarian on the deal. If people want to use crack, it's up to them, as long as they're not driving a car or ripping off my house.
Mm-hmm.
And if they took the profit out of drugs, people would certainly be ripping off a lot less houses. All right, here is, here's Josh in Westland. Hi, Josh, you're on the air.
Hi.
I'd
like to make comment on the whole bill for sending American businesses overseas. What I don't quite understand is why don't they make another bill or add on to that bill in order to regulate it, making it so you have to have so many businesses in America before you can, put more businesses overseas.
Well, I hear you. And, unfortunately, that didn't occur when it began to occur. And when all of a sudden it was evident that some of these countries were starting to take their business first to Mexico, I'm talking like 50 years ago, and that somebody should have foreseen either the unions who were, slow on the uptake when the businesses over 50 years ago started relocating to the American South so they wouldn't have to pay good union wages and benefits, that there should have been, if you are leaving the United States, there's something like a $10 million exit fee, which would have meant they wouldn't have been able to do it because it wouldn't have been worth their while. The savings wouldn't have been that great. And would that have been constitutional? I don't know. But essentially what these firms have done is who have no allegiance. We're supposed to have allegiance to these companies. We're supposed to have allegiance to our country. These companies have no allegiance to their employees. They have no allegiance to the communities in which they're located. They just have allegiance to profits and to making it as easy for them to do business and as hard as possible for individuals to realize the kind of life they'd like to have. Remember, when people wanted the 8-hour day, the companies called out troops, actually U.S. troops and police, and shot people down in the streets. All right. Thank you very much, Josh. Appreciate your comments. Let's see. Here is Brenda and Warren. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. What's happening, Brenda?
Hi.
Can you turn your radio down?
Comment. Pardon me?
Can you turn your radio all the way off?
Off.
Oh, hang on a minute.
Okay.
U.S. troops and...
it's my favorite pastime, listening to myself.
Okay. The comment you guys made earlier about Vietnam veterans.
Which one?
About which one?
Yeah.
Shouldn't have made any.
Why not?
Because it's not your right.
What are you talking about? I have a right to say what I want. What are you, some kind of commie?
No.
Okay, let's get that straight.
But how old are you?
It's none of your beeswax.
Well, I'm pushing 50, and I'm not complaining about that.
Okay, it's all right. You don't ask...
I was married to a Vietnam veteran. I didn't
we already talked to this person.
Who?
So we already talked to her.
Her?
Yeah.
No, we didn't.
Yes. You already called tonight, right?
I called several times, but I never got through.
No, you... Yes.
No. You put me on hold 110 times.
Well, wait a minute. Why can't anybody who wants to say whatever they want about anybody publicly, as long as this is a public forum?
Well,
yeah.
For one, Vietnam was not a public issue. It was a government issue.
Okay. I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you for your opinion. We got to go on and get some more. Is that a man or a woman? Well, the guy that was earlier was a guy.
No.
Early, that was a woman?
Yes. Same woman that was married to the Vietnam vet. Same one.
Oh, okay.
I have a good ear for this kind of thing.
Here's George in South Carolina. Hey, George, you're on the air.
Hey, right on. Hey, back again. I was listening to you guys the other weekend when I was up a little late, like I am now.
Welcome.
But just commenting on the smoking ban, you guys are doing it up in Michigan now.
Yeah.
And being that I used to live there, like I said, 8 years ago, last time I spoke with you guys, they did that back down here not too long ago when the city council, the members were on their last, let's say, hurrah. And, of course, the establishment that I go to is kind of like, let's say, Gus Lane Alley down Royal Oak.
I love that place.
Yeah, construction worker bar, you know, good hangout place.
Sure.
And of course, the owner smokes. And we were reading the ordinance, and I said, well, why don't we make it a private club? Charge someone, or charge everybody comes in a buck and make a little ID card for them. And we read the ordinance. You couldn't even do that with it.
Probably not, because, you know, there is this thing about public accommodations, and if you're licensed under the state, everybody's got to be able to have access and all that. So,
I mean, it would be sad, though. The guy who smokes and who owns his own bar can't even smoke in his own bar. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
No one. No one can smoke.
Yeah, and it used to be, in order, you had to smoke if you went to Gasoline Alley. I mean, if...
it's pretty much... I was there a few weeks ago.
A lot of smoke?
A lot of smoke.
Yeah.
You know what, though? People do cut down. When you can't smoke inside, people cut down on smoking.
Yeah. I mean, they're not... It's not like... taken away like all their
you can't smoke at all.
Yeah. They can go outside when
they can smoke at your house.
George, we got to move on because we're almost at the end of the show and lots of callers. Thank you for your opinion. Thanks for listening way down there in South Carolina. They actually censured Governor Mark Sanford. Remember the guy that was hiking the Appalachian Trail?
Yeah, quote unquote.
Yeah, another term for
Venezuela, right. Argentina.
Yeah. Let's see. Here is Eric Erickson Ypsilanti. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, I'm fine. First of all, I want to talk about Haiti. My heart goes out to the people of Haiti, and I make a full recovery.
Sure. Well, I don't know. The full recovery, they didn't have much to start with.
They were in recovery as it was.
I hear you. But give me some short answers. I got to go through this pretty quickly here.
Okay. Now, Pat Robertson and Rush Limbaugh should both be in jail.
Thank you.
But the only problem is there's not only conservatives in this country that are racist, there are also some liberals, too, not saying you guys are one of them.
We are not.
I don't think there's too many liberals who are racist. If you're a racist, you become a right-winger.
Right.
You can't be. You can't be
a
liberal.
There is a thing called white privilege.
Well, there is.
Well, yeah.
I mean, we have that just by virtue of skin privilege is what they call. But Eric, if one of the definitions of being a liberal is tolerance, and if anyone expresses anybody who is an overt racist is in the Republican Party.
I think that Eric's right that there is a lot of internalized racism amongst people who consider themselves not racist. Don't you think?
Speak for yourself.
Oh, not with me.
Okay. We're talking about some of these other people.
Yeah.
Well, you're not talking about this thing with Harry Reid, the senator from Nevada.
Oh, no. I'm talking about certain liberals people that consider themselves liberals are racist.
Well, there may be.
There's bound to be a few.
But,
yeah.
But you're not a good liberal. You're not a good liberal if you're a race. In fact, you're not a good American.
If you're not a good person.
You're not, in fact, you're a hard person if you're a racist. All right. Thank you, Eric. Appreciate your call. Here is Len in Brownstown. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey,
Len. Go ahead. You're on the air.
You want to turn your radio off?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Go ahead, bro. You're on
the
air.
It's all you.
Yeah, it's all about you. Len, we're getting down to that.
Well, no, you're wasting precious minutes.
Yeah, we're going to get somebody else, and we'll be back to you. Here is Devin. Devin's in Davisburg. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, they kind of about the smoking ban.
Yeah.
I really do believe it's great. Now I'm a smoker that they're trying to cut back. I've quit, honestly. Where I work, there's a rule you have to be 25 feet from the front of the building if you're going to go out and smoke.
Wow.
With the banning it in, you know, places like restaurants or the privately owned diner that I go to that, you know, I go there because a bunch of buddies of mine, when we're all have a day off, we smoke, you know, get some coffee and probably end up ordering some food. But, you know, it's nice that, you know, we can sit down and smoke there. And
what do you
I
mean?
Honestly believe that we'll start going, you know, just staying at home if we're going to hang out now.
What do you mean, privately owned?
There's some privately owned places, and there's some others that aren't privately owned we go to. I mean, we go to, you know, a couple places we go to a lot to smoke and to hang out if we all have days off.
Well, maybe you'll adjust as time goes on.
Yeah, I mean, because one of the
things... You guys can all go gather and go back in and eat and then go back out and smoke and go back in and eat.
I mean, I think it's like you said.
I went to the Magic Bag a couple weekends ago, and it was people in and out of that place.
Well, they had no smoking?
They went non-smoking a little while back.
Oh, I haven't been there in a while. That used to be another place.
No more smoking, Peter. You can go.
All right. All right, Devin. Good luck on cutting down on smoking or good luck on finding a place where you can smoke.
I never want to tell anyone what to do, but it might help you cut down for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, anything in moderation.
Well, you know, like me, I fess up on this show every once in a while. You don't get this voice without having a couple cigarettes in your lifetime. No, I'll have a drink and I'll have one once in a while. So I'm with you people. I'm with you smokers.
I hope it's not like date night or anything. You know, we used to say kissing a smoker is like licking an ashtray.
I refrain from discussing my personal life.
Yeah, but I will. I mean, remember why I've said it on the air, haven't I? Why I quit smoking when I was like a kid?
Your wife didn't like it.
Didn't like it. She wouldn't kiss me.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
She would just, you know, look at me and you know, get ready to smooch. And she'd go, you smell terrible. So I thought, man, this is worth it. And I was right. Len, are you there with us? You're on the air.
I don't know, Len.
Len is not
Len's
there.
Off somewhere.
Yeah, okay, Len. Don't think it hasn't been swell.
That was very swell. Nice bonding.
All right. We're going to head out. Jalene's got to get up real early and do some rock and roll.
Can't believe I'm here.
Yeah, I know. I can't wait to hear you. You go, anyway, it's Martin Luther King
Later
Day.
Than that, deeper the voice.
Some of you here. I will see down at Central Methodist United Church.
Yes.
At Adams at Woodward by Comerica Park. Noon today. It's just in about 11 hours. But on this show, you can stay tuned for a couple of interesting interviews. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling again. Jade, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jade.
Yeah. And
we appreciate you.
We'll do this, next week.
Okay.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Woohoo!
Win big at the casino?
Nope, better than that. I just got a great deal at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Ah, yes, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. The online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses.
I always look there first. They're the best bet for online coupons and discounts.
This week, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com is featuring Axis Music Academy in Southfield and Canton, A1 Services Auto Repair and Detailing in Livonia, and Photo Video Creations in Dearborn Heights.
Jackpot! Nobody beats MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Deal yourself a winning hand. Save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your own home when you connect to amazing deals like these and more at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-493-8159. Now you have qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. Call right now for your second chance. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
101.1 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. As most of you know, when people say to me, probably to you too, where do you live? And if you're in this area, we say, oh, I'm from Detroit. Although I live in one of the Detroit suburbs, and probably the greater majority of you listening live in the suburban area. Sometimes I even get people 60, 70 miles out from Detroit saying, yeah, I'm from Detroit. And you say, where are you? And they say, town. I'm thinking, man, that's pretty far from here. But there's this urban identification, sometimes great loyalty, even patriotism with sports teams and what have you, oriented around cities. And cities, as they developed thousands of years ago, they began the process of civilization. It was where learning and culture developed, but it always there's been a dark side of the concentration of people, disease, corruption, and if you think about and some of the early cities, well, even not so long ago, 19th century London, some of the slums of America, some of the slums of the world. There's a book called Planet of Slums by Michael Davis that I would highly recommend. That's just this frightening portrait of these cities that are filled with migrants from the countryside as their subsistence living has been destroyed. So many, many negative critiques of cities. Remember there's some old song by Canned Heat, going up the country, got to get out of the city. It's not a great place for people to live. But it has so many good things about it as well. And people, urbanologists, are beginning to have a sense of a new city, that we don't have to use the old definitions that were mostly based around just financial and industrial concerns. And a very interesting book has come my way. It's called Common Ground in a Liquid City. Common Ground in a Liquid City, Essays in Defense of an Urban Future. It's by Matt Hearn. And Matt Hearn lives and works in East Vancouver in British Columbia. He's the director of the Purple Thistle Center. He holds a PhD in urban studies. He lectures globally, and he teaches at the University of British Columbia and Simon Fraser University. He's written several books, including The Field Day, Watch Yourself, and Everywhere All the Time. Also, a book called Everywhere All the Time, A New De-schooling Reader. And it's a pleasure to welcome him. Matt Hearn is in New York City, where he's getting ready for a launch of the book. Matt Hearn, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, Pete.
Glad to do it. Now, tell us what a liquid city, and what, I mean, to actually explain the whole title, Common Ground in a Liquid City. What does that mean?
Well, the first explanation is that we've got too many syllables for one. That's a long and unwieldy title. I don't know what I was thinking. But the Liquid City part, it's kind of me getting metaphorically cute, in part because I'm writing from Vancouver, mm-hmm. which is, as you may well know, is a wash in water from both the rain and the ocean and the rivers and the glaciers. But larger sense than that, what I'm trying to write about is how cities can find a place in a world where people, where capital, where goods, where products, where investment are constantly sloshing around the world in apparently a kind of unmitigated flow with very little kind of restraints on it. So that's kind of the dual title there.
Okay, and in defense of an urban future, and why does an urban future need defending? Is it because what I said is there's so many negative critiques of urban life?
I think that's it. You know, most people reflexively talk about the city as a place that is just for commerce, is a place where people go, try to make some money, and get out as soon as they can. And for probably the last 120 years, ever since Victorian cities were kind of revealed in all their kind of degradation, the dominant thread of urban kind of literature and thinking, and in terms of popular thinking as well, has been, look, we got to get out of the city. You know, if you got any money, you move to the suburbs. If you have any money, you know, any serious money, you retire and get yourself a country place. And I think that there's two things that kind of motivated me to start thinking about how to defend the city. And one is, you've probably heard this in IBM ads and all over the place, the world is now an urban place.
Mm-hmm.
More people live in cities than anywhere else, and that's the first time that that's ever been the case in world history. The second thing is an ecological imperative. And I think that it's becoming clearer and clearer that if 7 billion people are going to live on this planet in anything like an ecological fashion, we're going to have to live densely. We're going to have to live compactly. We're going to have to learn to share resources, to share energy, to share land bases, stop sprawling so much. That is to learn to live in cities.
Well, some people might say, well, wait a minute. You're talking about limiting the quality of my life. I like to have a big house, you know, about the average suburban home now is like thousands of feet. It's got big lawns, and we like a lot of space. And, we might have to take down that little grove of trees there. We'll leave one or two for decoration, but I don't want to be jam-packed in with a lot of people.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, I mean, you're characterizing it in a funny way, you know, but there's some truth to that too, right? People do want, you know, people do want some space, right? You do, you know, I do get that sense. I totally understand what people are talking about. On the other hand, the sheer volume and the sheer scale of ecological destruction that our rampant energy use and sprawl has equaled are only now becoming, you know, completely apparent to everybody. And that somehow we are going to have to give up some stuff. A lot of us are going to have to give up something if we're going to make this, make it for the next 100 years. And sprawl, 4,500 square foot cul-de-sac mansions, 4-car garages, you know, those might be the first places to start thinking about ditching.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's cities and there's cities. There's Vancouver that I've never visited, but certainly everything I've ever read about it and people who do live there have told me it's a wonderful city to be in. Then you have Detroit proper, other Rust Belt deteriorating cities, and even worse, what I mentioned Mike Davis's, what the cities he references in Planet of Slums, and just maybe a big close one to us, Mexico City, last count maybe 23 million, and just horrible circumstances. And these are, as I said in the introduction, migrants coming off of the land who were in, who were involved in traditional subsistence farming and small market farming, and they've been ruined by NAFTA, and now they're crowding into the city. So that's a big sweep that I have. So there's Detroit, deteriorating people leaving, Mexico City, people driven off the land, and increasing the urban problems. Go ahead.
No, there's a ton of good comments in there. So I would say a couple things. Firstly, is that Vancouver is a particular example, and that's partially why I undertook this book, because as I've traveled around the world over the last, you know, decade or so, and you say you're from Vancouver, and people, you know, inevitably say, oh, there's a beautiful city.
Yeah, right.
And you talk to urbanists, and they go, oh, there's a city that gets it right. There's a city with, you know, that's well designed. And so Vancouver in North America, in many ways, has emerged as the poster child of sustainable urbanism, of progressive planning, maybe, you know, eclipsing what the position that Portland once held. And coming from Vancouver, I thought that was a little curious, because there's lots I love about Vancouver. There's tons to, you know, admire and appreciate about Vancouver. On the other hand, Vancouver has emerged as maybe the ideal neoliberal city. We're talking about a city that's got the lowest minimum wage in Canada, the highest rates of child poverty in Canada, the highest rents, and a burgeoning homelessness crisis, just to name a few things.
Let me just interrupt you a second. And when I'm not sure everybody is familiar with the phrase neoliberal, most people think of liberal as a you know, the traditional liberal that would take care of people and try to have safety nets and raise the standard of living and raise the minimum wage.
Yes, sorry about that. Not to get all academic on you there. Let me describe it like this. Vancouver is a city which has got tremendous amounts of poverty, vastly more than most visitors to the city, with tourists, of course, ever notice, and a huge kind of disparity living cheek by jowl. It's a pretty place in lots of ways, and it's a place that has had a lot of success in inducing people to move downtown, to densify, to reduce their footprint. There's lots of good things going on about Vancouver, but in many ways there's a lot to question about Vancouver, and I think a whole lot to question, in particular in the time of real estate speculation, because Vancouver has been built almost exclusively by and for real estate developers. That's why Vancouver is a progressive city right now, is because it's got money to burn. But we know what it looks like when a real estate market goes bubble. So that's a long answer to your question there, Peter. I haven't actually answered it yet, except to say that as I was traveling around, I began to think about Vancouver a little bit. You know, when you're in another city, you kind of get a bit of clarity about your own city.
Sure.
So, you know, when I was in another city, I would get an idea about, about Vancouver. I'd think, why is it like this here or like that there? And then I would start thinking about Vancouver a little bit. And then so the book that I just finished is 10 essays. Each of them are written from another city, thinking about Vancouver a little bit, thinking about that city, then thinking about Vancouver, and then thinking about trying to answer the question, what would a good city look like? And that's really the project, then, is to think about not just a place like Vancouver, where it's got a lot going for it in lots of ways, in particular in terms of money, but a city like Detroit that is on the downside right now, or a city like Mexico City, or a city like Istanbul that, you know, is existing on a scale that's, you know, kind of hard to get your head around, that's 17 million or 20 million.
Sure.
That's really the question I was at. That's the really question I was asking, is if it's true, if you buy my argument that an ecological future has to be an urban future, then how can we make that livable? How can we make that, you know, what could a good city look like?
My guest on the Peter Werby Show is Matt Hearn, pardon me, and his brand new book is Common Ground in a Liquid City, Essays in Defense of an Urban Future. It's published by AK Press, a publisher I would highly recommend. It's akpress.org, and you can go to Matt's site as well, Mighty Matt Hearn, HERN.com. I'll have a link on my website as well, and I'll repeat this all for you a little later as we progress in the interview. Now, Detroit seems to most observers like, you know, it's like ground zero of the capitalist crisis in terms of unemployment, which in real terms may be as high as 50%, urban devastation, high taxes, bad service, close to bankruptcy, terrible schools, and yet, as you probably know, the city went from 50, 60 years ago from 2 million people to, we'll probably come in at under 800,000. So there are hundreds, probably thousands of acres of empty land, not empty lots, as some people say, but empty land. And one wag once said, almost ready for farming. Well, it is, and it's being farmed. There's a lot of urban agriculture. Does Detroit, that looks like it's one of the more devastated places, actually maybe have the context for a renewal?
I think that's what you got is exactly correct, right? Which is that in the devastation of Detroit, that an entirely new kind of way of thinking about cities is starting to emerge. You know, I don't know, there's a story in the New York Times on the Sunday yesterday or 2 days ago, I guess now, about just the degree of small business flourishing in Detroit now, of new kind of enigmatic businesses kind of springing up. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing in many cities around the world. So maybe the best example is in Havana, Cuba, because after the fall of the Soviet Union, Cuba in general, but Havana in particular, essentially just had their food source cut off. The freighters that were just kind of coming daily from the Soviet Union, supplementing their food in pretty much every sphere, just kind of stopped coming. But not only did their food stop coming, but their fertilizers and their pesticides for growing food and most of their oil and gas stopped coming as well. So in a matter of a couple of years, actually in a matter of about a year, Cuba in particular, but Havana in specific, was kind of thrown into a food crisis, and literally people were starving. The average citizen of Havana lost 25 pounds in a year. They call that in the special Cuban vernacular, they call that the special period, which is not particularly special, but essentially over the last decade, Cuba has undergone a revolution, and Havana is now growing vast, vast amounts of food, not because it was some kind of master plan, but because people were hungry, and they just started growing food. They started growing food in coffee cans. They started growing back alleys. They started growing rooftops. And now just the city of Havana produces 98% of its own fruit and vegetables and a million tons of meat and dairy just within the city limits.
Now, and that could be done in Detroit as well. In fact, there's urban farming to the extent that at the Eastern Farmers Market, there's a whole section called Grown in Detroit, and there's going to be the United States Social Forum that's happening in Detroit on June 20th to 26th, and urban agriculture and its potential is going to be one of the large focuses. The capacity to feed oneself, hey, that sounds pretty good. But Matt Hearn, tell us about your organization that you're the director of, the Purple Thistle Center. That's right in an urban area in East Vancouver. What's its function?
Yeah, it's actually a youth center. It's a youth community center that I started with six teenage friends of mine that were not particularly keen on school and were kind of drifting away. And so I sat down with them about 10 years ago and I said, you know, if we were to start a center for you, that would be perfect. It would be not a school, not a community center, not a youth center, but something else entirely. What would it look like? And so we just began to talk about that, about what a home base for teenagers in East Vancouver would look like that would provide them a sense of grounding, a sense of, you know, accomplishment, a place of opportunity, you know, a place for them to gather. And so we just started building it over the last decade. Now it's a pretty thriving place with a couple hundred kids who use it regularly, and it's open pretty much 24/7 with, you know, a full range of activities and classes and workshops and stuff.
Now in Detroit again, I think they say that the youth unemployment rate is about 30%. Other people say it could be as high as 60 or 70%, and so frequently poverty, no work, what's generated then? I mean, by its very nature, crime. People are always trying to study, why are these people criminal? Well, usually because they don't have any money, except for the big ones. The big guys, they've got lots, but we're talking about the crime that visits us in cities. And so you have a situation where you have very many poor, unemployed youth. I mean, that is a prescription for a crime wave, which has not been realized. I mean, that hasn't happened. And it could. So the idea of a youth center that had values of having them have an investment in their areas, in the urban areas. I don't know if you're familiar with the Heidelberg Project in Detroit. That has a little of that. But do you think that the model of the Purple Thistle Center would work in other areas as well?
Well, I mean, I think for sure, but it's not like it's a model that the Purple Thistle has particularly done. We have our own unique way of doing things. But I guess the lesson that I've learned in running the Thistle is to trust people, is that people of all kinds are eminently capable of running major, in fact, probably all aspects of their own lives, in particular when we can do it collaboratively. And that's really part of the lesson that I've learned is in community organizing, is that problems that appear to be monstrous, that appear to be take, you know, a massive kind of effort from some sort of, you know, superhuman folks, is really not true. And I think the model of collaborativism and the model of cooperative building, of rebuilding the city, I think is real powerful. And I've learned that, particularly when you were talking earlier about urban agriculture, I learned that watching my neighborhood in particular, bit by bit, as kind of transform, as people have gotten over the last, you know, few years, like pretty much all over North America, super interested in urban agriculture. And it's much easier than you think. The idea of remaking a city, the idea of rebuilding a city and rethinking it, is much easier than you think. It's a much more pleasant, but also much more collaborative process than you might assume at first. I mean, I assumed at first blush.
Well, I think you just hit on a key word, collaborative. I think most people think, what can I do? Most people are these atomized fragments of the economy and of the political system. Sometimes they're fortunate enough to be part of, unions or churches or what have you that bring people together. But I suspect that the vast majority of people in the United States, at least, and are address the world as isolated individuals, and the idea of transforming the world or transforming even their block or their neighborhood or their community is probably pretty daunting.
Yeah, and I think that's, in large respect, some of the legacy of suburbia, right, which is that so many of us live so far away, so isolated from our neighbors. We drive enormous cars for extremely long distances. We work, 8 to 10 hours a day and are exhausted. You know, most people, frankly, are exhausted by the demands of keeping up the lifestyle. And the capacity or the even just the sheer energy for making friends with your neighbors is, it's a tough haul.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough haul. And I think that some of the promise of what a revitalized cities can promise is not just reducing our footprint, but the increase of social capital. That is to say, the community networks, bonds of reciprocity, community organizations that have traditionally kind of enlivened and given life to cities.
Well, it's interesting. We, in my neighborhood, in my suburban neighborhood, one of the old suburbs adjacent to Detroit, we recently established a block club. And we were told by the city, you'll probably get 6 or 7 people showing up all over 70 years old. We were getting 50 people a crack at these meetings, and one of the things that draws people, it turns out that we don't even have that many problems. People, speeding on one of the streets, and not that that's not a problem, but we're not at any crisis level. But what has drawn people together is the desire to be drawn together, to have some connection with their neighbors, to not live as these fragments. And that's not, I would suggest to people who are listening, that's if you don't have a block club in your area, that's a darn good way to start. Would you agree?
I agree, and it's not just sort of an aesthetic thing, a nice thing to do. It's actually real important, because those are the things, those kind of bonds of what they would call bonds of reciprocity or just plain old neighborliness. They're just so vital, right? The idea that you might know somebody who you can go get childcare in an emergency for. You could say, run over to your neighbor and go, hey, could you take care of my kids for an hour?
Yeah.
Those are the things that begin to make people feel like they have a place, particularly in the city, like their entire fate is not just sitting on their shoulders. The idea that they're not alone. And that feeling in turn begins to create a sense of security whereby people don't feel like they have to work, 60 hours a week and stress and hoard and keep their money secretive to themselves. Because there's nobody there to take care of them in a time of trouble. And the thing I would say also is that there's nothing that brings people together like food. People will come together. People love to come together to eat. And so I've been doing stuff in my neighborhood park whereby I gather about 30 or 40 people from around the park to have a potluck in the park, where everybody brings a dish, and I get everybody to bring a big dish, and I set out a few tables out in the park, and then I wander around the neighborhood and I invite anybody that looks real broke or homeless or sleeping on the street to come and share the meal with us.
Oh.
And so we just bring out a bunch of extra plates and a bunch of extra dishes and big huge thing of tea and coffee and stuff. And it's real simple and it's real easy, but it's an opportunity for people to middle class people or people with houses to get together and visit and hang out with people who maybe don't. And the kind of net result of that is that people, when they're sharing a meal, you get to feel a little less frightened of them.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of the kid with a tattooed face who's been begging for money down by the SkyTrain, all the time, and you're afraid to talk to him because you're afraid he's going to jump you. Instead, he's sharing a meal and thanking you for it, right?
Sure.
And it doesn't solve anything particularly, but it begins to create a more convivial neighborhood, right? A place where people are less afraid of each other.
And on the streets. Yeah, I mean, there starts to be a cafe culture or more of a street culture in the best sense of it, like there is in Europe. We just have a couple minutes more with Matt Hearn. He's the author of Common Ground in a Liquid City, Essays in Defense of an Urban Future. It's available from AK Press, akpress.org, and I'll give you some more website addresses at right at the end. But the whole, I mean, this saying's been around for a long time, think globally, act locally, and we've been doing both here. We were just talking about acting locally, but let's go globally a little. I think there is a possibility for a resurrection of Detroit based on new concepts of the old industrial urban ones out the door, and we've got to start revisioning what our future can be, and I think a book like this is an excellent place to get ideas. But, I mean, are some cities hopeless? I mean, can you actually have a Mexico City or some of the African or Asian cities and have any coherence in them that would not make it look like, you know, 19th century London? I mean, they seem almost hopeless to me.
Yeah, you know, I totally get that feeling. And sometimes, you know, I actually grew up in a country, and I live in a fairly small city of Vancouver. So you go to a city, like I spend quite a bit of time in Istanbul, and it's just so big and so sprawling, you know, that sometimes you think, like, oh, I don't even know where to start thinking about it. But the thing that I kind of latch onto is firstly, is people's unbelievable resilience, right? Mm-hmm. And incredible creativity. And the ability of people to remake a city in short order, to be able to take over, to be able to re-inhabit, you know, abandoned buildings, to be able to take over, like you're saying, lots and to grow food in them, to be able to rethink it. So that's the part that gives me faith, and I see it. I've seen it, and I'm sure you've seen it, and, you know, many of folks listening have seen that. You know, they've seen incredible places of people figuring out ways to thrive in conditions that, at first faith kind of value, look like they're hopeless. But there's no reason to think they're hopeless, and I think there's every reason to have lots of faith in people's flexibility and hard work and creativity.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Matt Hearn, for being on the show. And we're so pessimistic about the future of the city that gives our area the name Detroit. And it's there's people on the ground doing things already. And Matt Hearn's book, Common Ground in a Liquid City: Essays in Defense of an Urban Future, gives you an idea from his travels what can be done, and perhaps absolutely has to be done if we're going to have an urban future. You can go to Matt's website, mightymatthearn.com. That's MATTHERN.com. You can also access the book through akpress.org, and I would highly recommend them as a publisher to get great information. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Matt Hearn, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, Pete. And I should say one thing, too, before I go, is that, you know, in past years, you know, for a long time, whenever I heard the word Detroit, people would just kind of, you know, make a grunting noise. But over the last couple of years, Detroit is synonymous with all kinds of people all around North America with really interesting and really vibrant urbanism. People overwhelmingly say, you should go to Detroit, and you should see what's going on there. So I've never been to Detroit, but I'm looking forward to coming.
Hey, we invite you. Thank you, Matt Hearn.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
It's another new year, and your debt is higher than ever. Credit card balances that keep growing. Rising medical bills. Maybe you lost your job, or you're afraid of losing your home. That's the bad news. But you can work through your debt problems with help from Credit Card Relief. No, we're not a consolidation loan, not another one of those credit counseling deals, and not bankruptcy. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. If you're struggling with too much credit card debt, call us for a free consultation. We have an outstanding record of performance helping people get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
Do you see chalky water spots on your dishes and tub that drive you crazy? Those spots are a warning that your plumbing may have a serious limescale buildup. What you can't see is limescale clogging your pipes, breaking down your appliances, and blocking their heating elements. And that could be costing you $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove hard water limescale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare. Just visit bestofwater.com. HydraCare has been sold for years by the major utility in England as the ideal treatment to reduce and prevent limescale. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. Guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestofwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestofwater.com. That's bestofwater.com.
101 The Riff.
Jeez, Q, it's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Shh. Ouch! The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet?
No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
No.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Peter Werby here with you. Thank you for joining me. If you've listened to this broadcast for any amount of time, you know I always talk about how history is made. It's not made by the politicians, the big shots. They make decisions sometimes, of course, that affect us all. But it's not the way that the fundamental changes that have occurred throughout this country have gone down. Beginning with the Revolutionary War, the abolitionist movement, the suffragettes, where the women finally got the vote. Certainly the labor movement, the anti-war movements of the 1960s, the feminist movements, the gay movements, all of that was done with a grassroots organizing. It means people just like you and me, or if you think, hey, I'm on the air, I'm not a grassroots guy, people just like you listening took hold of history, shaped it, made it happen. And there's a bumper sticker that says, if the people lead, the leaders will follow. So it's not that easy, though. If you're driving in your car, if you're sitting at home, you're thinking, hey, there's just one of me. I can't do anything all by myself. The powers that are laid against us are enormous. They're organized. They've got money. I'm nothing. I'm just sitting here in my home wishing things were different. Well, there is something called creative community organizing, and it's a brand new book by Cy Kahn. Its subtitle is A Strategy Manual for Rabble-Rousers, Activists, and Quiet Lovers of Justice. And Cy Kahn is the founder of Grassroots Leadership, and he's got an incredible history. He's worked for more than 45 years as a civil rights, labor, and community organizer. He's the founder, as I said, of Grassroots Leadership, a national progressive organization that works to abolish all for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers, and for humane alternatives to incarceration and immigrant detention. He's the author of a number of books, and he is just about to release his 15th CD of original songs, and it goes along, it's called Courage, and it goes along with his book, Creative Community Organizing. We're reaching him at his home in North Carolina. Cy Khan, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, I am honored to be on the show. It's good to be back in Detroit, one of the great cities of the world.
Tell us what you mean. What do you mean, back in Detroit? You've visited before.
Oh, I've been to Detroit a lot of times, you know, both to be on the radio, but also because of friends in the labor movement, United Auto Workers, and, you know, to be there with, you know, the really good, honest, hardworking people who built the infrastructure of this country, who built its buses and trucks and cars and automobile bills and SUVs. You know, the tragedy of Detroit, and I don't mean this is a tragic town, it's a town with a lot of spirit and a lot of heart, but the tragedy is exactly what you were talking about, Peter, in your introduction, that they have the money, they have the power, they make the decisions, and people who have spent their entire lives working hard, you know, paying their dues in every sense of the word, going to work 5, 6, 7 hours a day, working overtime, have the ground cut out from under them for the greater profit of some corporation. Now, where is the justice in that?
Now, there's a song, I can't remember, it's on a United Steelworkers album, it's called It's a Shame the Way the Big Boss, how does that go? It's a shame the way the big boss, he treats you, works you like a mule, treats you like a dog, it's a shame the way the big boss, something like that. But, yeah, all right, so we're here, and you've looked, given your history in civil rights and labor and community organizing, most people have a hopeless sense. It's we're dust in the wind. We're just chips to be blown around. The big shots make all the decisions. They make it's the golden rule. He who has the gold rules.
And not always wisely or well.
How do we do it? How do we do creative community organizing, Cy Khan? That's the title of your new book.
Well, first, Peter, I don't have any magic bullet. And I don't have any secret answers. It's not as if people read this book, which I sure hope they do, but it's not as if they read this book, all of a sudden they're going to be able to turn these lives around, turn the auto industry around, turn Detroit around, turn this country around. That's a long, long, long struggle. But what I say in this new book, Creative Community Organizing, by the way, it's now retitled A Guide for Rabble-Rousers, Activists, and Quiet Lovers of Justice. What I say in the book is, if you look at history, while there have been desperate times, dark times, hard times, like Detroit is going through now, like the country is going through now, they have always changed for the better eventually, and they have only changed because of the organized power of everyday people. I don't talk about ordinary, but I used to talk about ordinary people. Now, I don't do that because who's ordinary?
Mm-hmm. Right?
But everyday people. I mean, people who, you know, have to show up at the hospital, show up at the plant, show up at the school every day, do their job as well as they can, try to make ends meet, do their best by their kids if they choose to have kids, or if they're lucky enough or unlucky enough to have kids, you know, I'm lucky with our kids. But, the only way that anything ever changes is if and when numbers of people organize and try to make a difference. And in the book I say, you know, even if you do that, even if you work with great organizers, and I've had the great good fortune to work with some of the best organizers in this country, even if you give your heart and your soul and your work and your money and everything to make a change, there is no guarantee that things will get better. The only guarantee is that if we do nothing, that nothing will ever change.
Well, the other thing, Cy Khan, is that you also redefine yourself. I was reading an account of Condoleezza Rice's history from the Bush administration, and when the Montgomery boycott began years ago and Martin Luther King came to town, the day that there was going to be these demonstrations, her conservative father sent her for a tennis lesson. So you can look back, and this is history here. Sometimes, you know, people
that's
don't...
Right. That's really...
So what did you
How's your game?
Yeah, probably pretty good. So you can ask yourself, did you take part in history-making events? Were you part of this exciting change? Maybe that didn't, in her case, or in the case in Montgomery, was successful. But or were you off on some trivial matter and missed the boat as a human being?
Well, I think that's true. But I don't think you have to be there on the dramatic day that Dr. King, may he rest in peace, is coming to town. Part of my belief about creative community organizing is the way you get it done is not by asking people to do heroic acts, dangerous acts. I have known people who had great courage. I don't think I'm one of them. But I've known people who had great courage and were willing to take extraordinary risks. But frankly, the great majority of people aren't going to do that. And they're not going to volunteer 40 hours a week, and they're not going to do, they might like to, but the boss is saying, no, you can't have 5 days off the door knock, right? It's a reality. Mm-hmm. So the secret of creative community organizing, first is if you ask somebody to do one thing and one thing only, right? You don't say, oh, could you do this and could you do this? You know, could you come stuff envelopes? Could you, could you go talk to your workers at the hospital, co-workers at the hospital? Oh, we need a volunteer tonight to help staff the meeting. And could you, say, hey, we have one thing that we need you to do, one thing and one thing only. And you make it something that's fun for people and you make it something that is not that hard for them to do. Now, some people will catch fire and will say, well, I could do more than that. But you, the creative community organizer shouldn't be the one to say, I need you to do more than that, unless there's a long-term developed relationship. So one of the mistakes I find that people make is they say, here's a sample conversation. The organizer says, we really need your help. And the person said, I care about this issue. I will do whatever I can. The organizer says, that's great, because we need people who can do anything they can. And the person says, well, just anything you need, I'll do it. And then nothing ever happens, because you never define what the organization or the campaign needed or what the person could do. I encourage people, this is one of the things in the book, if you're working with an organization or campaign, come up with like the 32 things that you need. And when somebody says, I'd love to help, you say, look, I've got this list here of things we need. Why don't you pick the one out that would give you the most pleasure, maybe the one you're good at, maybe something you want to learn, something that would give you a sense of satisfaction. Let's get you to do that one. And then I think you find that you have much more passionate, much more committed, and much more effective volunteers.
My guest is Cy Kahn. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. The book, correctly, as I see now in the release, I have actually an advance uncorrected galley with the subtitle a little different, but it's Creative Community Organizing, a Guide for Rabble-Risers, Activists, and Quiet Lovers of Justice. It's published by Barrett Kohler, and there'll be a link at Cy's site, which is Grassroots Leadership. I've lost it again. We were talking.
Right. Hey, no, you're good. You're good. You're good. All you need to get is the
leadership.
G at the end.
Oh, no. Grassroots leader.
Do we do the WWW anymore?
No, no. Here, okay. Let me try it, Cy.
I tried to get people to do it IWW, but it didn't work.
I hear you. That's a.
No,
here.
It's grassroots leadership, one word.
.org.
O-R-G.
Yeah. So it's grassrootsleadership.org.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And why do I have trouble writing things down like this? You ever have that problem?
No, but I have my partner and spouse, the feminist and public philosopher Elizabeth Mitic, also my co-author on a book we did 5 years ago called The Fox in the Henhouse, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. Elizabeth said, I am donating your brain to science because somebody has to figure out why these things happen. And I just said, are we talking before or after, right? It's of significant importance to me. But I have very strange synapses, so I often misinterpret things. Would you like a story about Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and me?
Sure. And I hate to say this, but there are probably some people that don't know who Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie were.
Why don't you tell them?
Well, just real quickly, sort of the fathers of modern American folk music, Pete Seeger, who I've interviewed on this show. Woody Guthrie was an enormous influence on Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan went to see Woody Guthrie in the hospital as he was expiring from this disease. And so when you hear, when you trace this line through folk music and into rock and roll, it goes back to people like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. But yeah, go ahead.
Okay, that's good. And you know, if you've ever sung the song, which is in every, you know, K through 6 songbook, "This Land Is Your Land," Woody Guthrie wrote that.
Yeah.
So I was on tour with Pete Seeger back in the 80s, and like for the fifth time that day, I had read something and it turned out to be entirely wrong. Like I don't know, but like the sign would say South Water Street, and I would say, oh, you know, some worker's song, and he'd say, where did you get that? I'm like, it's on the sign there, and he's like, nothing. There's nothing on the sign there that has anything to do with what you just said. And I'm like, well, don't you? Doesn't that happen to you all the time? And he said, no, it never happens to me. He said, but you know what? It happened to Woody Guthrie all the time.
Hmm.
Now, he had a brain disease, so.
Well,
so
I know.
It may not be something one wants, but it was, but Peter, I think actually that it does this. You know, I don't know the structure of my own brain, and you know, I probably won't be there for the autopsy. Well, not in a sense that gives me a whole lot of information. I do think that the connections in my brain it's like, you know, jump starting a car. There's a lot of sparks. I do think that's what's made me both a songwriter and to some sense a reasonably creative community organizer, because without my working to do so, my brain just kind of shoots me outside of the ordinary.
Well, that's good. That's a positive quality, because the ordinary is what is, and if we want to change things, we have to move beyond it. I should say also that Woody Guthrie is the father of Arlo Guthrie, who many of our listeners may know of from a lot of the songs.
Will now do an extemporaneous 30-minute version of Alice's Restaurant.
That's right. Well, of course, that's what people would know him best for. Cy Conn is my guest. He is the author of Creative Community Organizing. Simultaneously with the release of this book, one of his several, a brand new one, is his 15th CD entitled Courage, and singer-songwriter. Is there a tie-in here or just coincidental?
Well, you know, it's not coincidental. It's carefully planned, but there's a relationship between the book and the CD. What I'm trying to say in both. First, I am trying to recognize and honor what I think is one of the most wonderful things about the American spirit. You know, when de Tocqueville, the French political scientist, traveled this country, you know, before our revolution, one of the things that he remarked on was the amazing voluntary spirit of Americans and our tendency to form associations, right? I mean, he looked at, you know, somebody's barn would burn down. The community would gather to rebuild the barn. They'd have a barn raising. Somebody needed a house. They'd have a log raising. A road needed fixing. People would turn out for a work day on the roads. You know, people, you know, such as Abigail Adams and John Adams and Sam Adams and Tom Paine decided that we needed a new form of government, and they became very, very creative community organizers. I think one of the best community organizing campaigns ever run in this country is the American Revolution. You know, all kinds of techniques is worth studying. So I want to honor that spirit, and both the book and the CD Courage, the book Creative Community Organizing, they are my thank you and tribute to, for example, all the shift workers in Detroit, all the hospital workers, all the orderlies, all the RNs and LPNs, all the school teachers, all the people doing good work in the public sector, the folks on the garbage truck, the sanitary workers, you know, the doctors, the street sweepers, everybody who pulls their shift. The book is about pulling your shift, and the CD is about pulling your shift. And I'm retelling stories both from my own personal experience and some of the great stories that people have just told me as I've traveled. I want to honor and lift up what I think is the greatest strength of this people, and that's the good-heartedness and willingness to work of its people.
You know, I think, Cy Conn, that it very I think what you said may be the answer to my next question. I was going to say, why? Why do all this? Why not just try to be a popular folk singer and have a career? I mean, why? Yeah, in a sense, you're dedicating your life to others. Or are you?
Well, you know, I think we all do things that matter to us. You know, I was raised quite religiously. My dad's a rabbi, and my mom was an artist. They're both long gone now. But they were very, very clear that we are not put on this earth, however you believe we got here, for ourselves alone. And we do not have a right to be selfish. We have an obligation to help other people. Now, I think that's actually a really good philosophy of life. But it's also the way I was raised, and it's what I believe. I feel good when I do what I do. You know, every once in a while, Peter, somebody will say, come up to me, and they mean well, and they say, it's great that you have sacrificed your life to help others. And I say, wait. I never sacrificed anything. I've had a remarkably, in fact, extraordinarily good life. I have a wonderful, wonderful long-term marriage to my best friend of 50 years. That's at the center of my life. We're lucky enough to have three healthy kids who work hard and do good things in the world. I have a circle of friends, and I said to Pete Seeger once, I said, we were on stage together, and I said, do you know that 15 years ago, I had to pay like $5 to get in to see you, and now you're saying, what do you want to do next, right? and I've had the opportunity to work with courageous people who are also wonderful people. I mean, this is not serious. People who told jokes, who had good stories, who enjoyed a laugh, who were happy to go to the bar after a meeting and have a beer or whatever. I have had such a gifted life, and I am so grateful for it. And I just wish that everybody in our country, in the world, had the chance for the kind of fundamentally good life that I've got. I mean, it breaks my heart to think, what is it, that 40 million children in the world go to bed not just hungry but starving every night? I mean, you know, my kids aren't doing that. I'm not worried about them. But I'm worried about other people's kids. I do this because it makes me feel good. And in the book, Peter, I'm trying to say to people, don't think of this as, we're not martyrs, community organizers. We're working folks like you, and a good life is possible. I want people to say, that actually sounds like a pretty good life. I mean, I want to be really clear. I work for a nonprofit organization. I get what I believe is a salary that's comparable to what auto workers used to make in the good days in Detroit. You know, I have a pension. I have a sabbatical plan. I have, you know, a lot of vacation days and holidays. I've got very, very good medical insurance. I've got a good job. So I am not sacrificing myself for anybody. I am lucky enough to have a job that has allowed me, working with Elizabeth, to raise a family, and it gives me the deepest of satisfaction. So well, I do it because I love it.
It doesn't get much better than that. And there's also, I think, what I do, I think there's an ethical component, given what I've been granted with through no work at all of my own, being Euro-American, being middle class, that I've been given a lot. And I think that within that equation, I should be giving back some as well to level the playing field so that other people that don't have the circumstances that I did, as you said, Cy Khan, is that that they have the same chance at a life without worry, without stress, without strain.
Well, bless your heart. And I mean, I think that for those, you know, good people, Peter, who are out there listening to you, my message to them is, I know what I'm saying isn't always going to make sense right now. You're like, yeah, I've been out of work for a year. What am I supposed to do? Join a union when I don't even have a job?
Mm-hmm.
And what I tell everybody when I try to tell people when I talk is, you know, I understand this may not make sense now. I mean, I understand that what I'm saying may not fit the circumstances of your life. But remember what I said about doing things with and for other people. Remember what I said about building an organization to take on power. And maybe 10, 15, 20 years down the road, you'll be in a situation where you think, who's that crazy guy I heard on Peter Werby's show who was talking about how we're not in it alone and if we organize, we get power? You know, maybe, you know, on the job, maybe you just got sexually harassed before you assume that it's your fault. Talk to the other women. Talk to the other men. Say, hey, is the boss hitting on you? And Because maybe it's not your problem, maybe it's everybody's problem. You know, if you got a problem in your neighborhood, don't assume that it's because of something you did, or don't assume that you're powerless. Talk to your neighbors. I'm not saying that every time we're going to win. I'm not saying every time. But I am saying if you do nothing, nothing changes. That's the message. And I believe when you listen to the CD Courage, there's stories of people. There's a story about a school custodian. There's a story about a guy whose father carries him on his shoulder from Liverpool, England to London to tell the king that Irish World War II veterans deserve jobs. And, you know, and some of them won and some of them lost. But it's about people who were willing to work with other people and to take the chance that their action may make a difference to their kids, to their partners, to their families, to their communities, to their faith community. And I really believe this is what this country stands for. Elizabeth Minnick, my partner, says, you know, she says, for all of your progressive politics, you are the most patriotic American I have ever run into in my life. And she's right. You know, I believe that the promise that this country made to its people is a profound and beautiful promise. And we just need to figure out how we make the people who are the institutions that have serious power, how we make them live up to that promise. We should not compromise with the multinational corporations who are shutting down Detroit and turning out the lights. We should not compromise with them about the dream of the United States. It's our dream. The big boys should not get to take it away from us.
And indeed, the revolutionary vision of democracy that came not totally out of the blue, to be sure, but was the first time it was ever codified. I mean, in the American Declaration of Independence, and particularly in the Constitution, and to expand democracy, and now we are going back in the other direction, where elites control more and more of our destiny, and if we do nothing, in fact, that was one of your phrases, Sycon, just earlier, if we do nothing, we can be assured, in fact, we'll be lucky. We'll be lucky if things remain like this. I mean, unless the people intervene in history right now, this is going to be the good old days.
No, absolutely. You know, on the CD Carter tour, there's a song about a custodian. What happens to him is, this is, by the way, I was on the radio, and a guy called up and told me this story. Radio is a very powerful medium in this country. And this guy named Grant called up, says, I'm a custodian, but I lost my job because they privatized. We were public employees. We used to watch out for the kids. You know, I used to make sure kids got home safely. If a kid was in trouble, I'd reach out to them. I'd talk to their parents. Now we just have some corporation. They don't care about the kids. They just care about the money. But there's a verse in that says, now we are standing at the edge of a forest of lies where all we hold in common has been privatized, where corporations own every corner of the land. If everything is private, where will freedom stand? And I really believe that. I think the problem is that what we built, I mean, we, the everyday people, the working people, the middle class people, the small business people, you know, the miners, the teachers, you name it, what we built is being given away to these multinational corporations. And they're not American corporations. They say, oh yeah, buy American, yeah, because your office is in New York, but the goods are made by children in China. And
well,
it's being given to them and sold back to us for the highest dollar.
And if
that's not America,
it isn't. And how can we fight back? Where's the information? It's in Cy Khan's brand new book from Barrett Kohler. It's Creative Community Organizing, a Guide for Rabble Rousers, Activists, and Quiet Lovers of Justice. You can go to Cy's website, grassrootsleadership.org. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe. That's werbe.com. You got me. .com. I'm having trouble with words today. Cy Khan, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Hey, Peter, you did a great interview. Thank you so much. And listen, tell everybody out there, better times will come.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF.
The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Woohoo!
Win big at the casino?
Nope, better than that. I just got a great deal at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Ah, yes, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. The online connection to half off or more deals from tons of Metro Detroit businesses.
I always look there first. They're the best bet for online coupons and discounts.
This week, MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com is featuring Axis Music Academy in Southfield and Canton, A1 Services Auto Repair and Detailing in Livonia, and Photo Video Creations in Dearborn Heights.
Jackpot! Nobody beats MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Deal yourself a winning hand. Save time and money by shopping from the comfort of your own home when you connect to amazing deals like these and more at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Are you having trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt, but now you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again, too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential, and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help you get out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Detroit's Rock Station, 101 WRIF.
The Riff.
101 WRIF.
The Riff.
Hey, this is Lars from Metallica.
The Riff. Hello, this is Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers.
The Riff.
Hello, this is Brian Johnson of AC/DC. You're listening to Detroit's home of rock and roll, WRIF.
Everything that rocks. Back to the rock.
This is a fantastic moment for me.
101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.